You're a wicked man.
Wicked?
You have no values.
Different values.
You won't be helped.
Destroyed.
You want to spoil things.
I won't be a goldfish in a bowl.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to the COVID Secure, not the BCFM Politics Show, on Friday the 25th of February, 2022. Streaming live from, well, actually from the metaverse somewhere. So we're not in People's Republic of Stokescroft today. We are distributed around Gloucestershire, Herefordshire and Bristol. That is also going live out on RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with relentless propaganda, hell-bent on turning our fine cities into hostile environments for us humans and herding us into the metaverse. Instead, navigating us calmly through the Fourth Reich, the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution Matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. This week, we'll be looking through particularly the extraordinary events. You couldn't have made it up, really. Just as COVID is put on the shelf on Thursday, so an enormous new thing turns up, which is the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Martin, I think we should probably both of us start off, because both of us have been on international media saying we didn't believe it was ever going to happen. I'll let you start by saying, you need, I think, to do a little bit of a confession and say how you got it so wrong.
Well, I mean, I was going along with what the official Russian government position was. I believe that there was going to be some kind of reaction to the demarche that the Russians presented in December about what their demands were. And I think the reason why they didn't flag up what they exactly intended to do is because from a military point of view, they wanted it to be a surprise. So just like everybody, I mean, don't forget the Ukrainian government itself was saying, we don't really think there's going to be an invasion and that the British and the Americans are exaggerating here. And I think that the British and the Americans didn't realise there was going to be an invasion, that the fact that there has been one has blindsided everybody. I mean, the British and the Americans have been saying that there's always been an invasion. So in a sense, them saying that there's going to be an invasion is like they always say that.
Well, that's awful. Marty, I think you'd be wriggling out of it so easily. I'll try not to. I mean, I was genuinely surprised yesterday when we saw this, woke up yesterday to see actual Russian troops on Ukrainian soil, because they've been trying, haven't they, for years and years. It's funny, when you talk about 2014, whenever the Western press talks about the year 2014, they say this is the year Crimea was annexed. But of course, it was a very, very different situation in reality, in that you had these two Lugansk and Donetsk People's Republics started fighting against the Kiev government quite legitimately, since Kiev was trying to get them to give up their Russian language and this sort of thing for cultural rights. And they certainly didn't want to be part of this new coup regime in Kiev. And what happened was certain parts of those two regions of Ukraine in the southeast, some of them became People's Republics. Some of them were actually still controlled by Kiev. So there's been this whole grey area about and also, of course, the Minsk agreement still talks about those two as part of Ukraine. So it's just about legitimate for when Russian troops come into Donetsk or Lugansk for the Western media to say, oh, well, there's been an invasion of Ukraine, can't they? They can just about get away with that. And that's what they've been saying.
Yeah, but I think when you point out the Minsk agreements say that the Ukrainian government must negotiate with the leadership of the breakaway republics. Now, there's been 7 years, and throughout that 7 years, they've absolutely refused to negotiate. And in actual fact, the Russians pressed them again. Are you going to negotiate? They said, no, we're not. And they've actually massed a whole army on the contact line, 100,000 troops. What do you need 100,000 troops there just to hold the contact line? So eventually the Russians saying, if you're not prepared to negotiate, this is your last chance, bang. And that's what's happened.
And of course, they can't flag it up beforehand that they're going to do it. But I mean, I do feel, yeah, I mean, I do feel sort of duped by them, really. And, you know, I have to apologise for anyone that's, you know, sort of believed anything that I said about
I think people get things wrong, Tony. Predicting the future is a mug's game anyway. When are the markets going to collapse? Come on, I want to know. Proper dates, well, please.
No, I'm not doing that. But I did genuinely think that the Russians would not actually invade Ukraine. Now it's actually happened, I can see the logic to it, which is very much, I don't know if you've seen the statement by Vladimir Putin yesterday morning on the 24th of February 2022. I'll just read out a little clip from it. He says, if we look at the sequence of events and the incoming reports, the showdown between Russia and these NATO forces cannot be avoided. It's only a matter of time. They're getting ready and waiting for the right moment. We cannot stay idle and passively observe these developments. This would be an absolutely irresponsible thing for us to do. For our country, it would be a matter of life and or death, a matter for our historical future as a nation. And this is not an exaggeration. It is a fact, says Putin yesterday morning.
Well, that's right. I mean, what they did in December is they put down a general policy about what the relations between the West and them should be. And they wanted it, they said, we need a proper security negotiation. You've got to take, because don't forget, the West has withdrawn from all of the nuclear agreements that they signed with the Soviet Union, unilaterally withdrawn from them. So the agreements that have been agreed for years between the dictatorship of the Soviet Union and the West, now you've got a democratic government in Russia, they've ripped them up. And that's not, and don't forget, if you rip up those agreements, think about the geography. Yeah. So they've got short range missiles in Poland and in Romania, which can be nuclear and can carry out a decapitation strike against Moscow. If they put similar missiles into Cuba, the Americans would go absolutely bonkers. So it's not unreasonable. And don't forget, when those missiles were originally deployed by the Obama regime, if we can call it that, they were said that these aren't directed at you. They're to protect Western Europe from the Iranians.
Actually, Martin, can I just contest you talking about Cuba? Because Cuba is a lot further away from Washington.
Oh, it's a 1,000 miles. This is much closer to Moscow.
Well, exactly. It's more Cuba. It's more like the Russians Mexico. Putting nuclear or in Quebec, say, for example, just near, yes, you know, just north in Canada. It's actually very close to Moscow. And I think that they're looking at these increases in the technology since there's been this hypersonic weapons arms race going on the last few years, yeah, saying, well, that 3-minute warning is now almost like a 30-second warning.
Well, that's right. And of course, the problem with having 30 seconds warnings, which is why they had all these deals with the Soviet Union to keep intercontinental ballistic missiles, so that if you fire at them at us, we've got half an hour to make up our mind what's going on. That means there's half an hour to correct any mistakes. Whereas if you've got these short range missiles, you've literally got minutes to decide whether it's an attack or not. And that's why the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty was signed between Gorbachev and Reagan to get rid of these short range missiles in Europe. But the Americans have ripped it up. They now say that they're willing to renegotiate it. But the Russians have said, well, hang on a minute, what was the matter with the deals we already had? And you can see, if Britain was in a similar position, plenty of political forces in this country, including the Labour front bench, believe that we should keep nuclear weapons because we can't trust the other people enough not to have them. And if the Russians had got short-range nuclear weapons in Ireland, pointed directly at London, what would we do?
Well, I think it's a good idea to sort of kick off by looking at what has actually happened, because it's not always easy to tell. Quite clearly, the Russian troops are in mid-Ukraine. They're in East Ukraine. They're in North Ukraine. They're in South Ukraine. Are they actually, do you know, Martin, spreading along the Black Sea coast as far as Odessa and places like that?
All right, I've been trying to work out what the actual military plan and situation is. And of course, the Russians do make certain statements about what they're doing and why they're doing it. But on lots of other things in warfare, you don't necessarily tell everybody exactly what you're doing. So you have to wait to see.
No, you don't say anything, in at least until you've established your objectives.
Well, that's right. So what it looks like, you see, there are a number of ways they could have approached this. I think the most significant political development was in the Russian parliament last week, when the the Communist Party were the main opposition party in Russia. You don't get any of this in the Western media. Putin's a dictator, blah, blah, blah. Navalny, who is being persecuted, he had a sort of a tool that people could use at the last election, the parliamentary election, who to vote for if you want to defeat United Russia. A bit like the kind of compass over here saying, who do you vote for to defeat the Tories? So that went out there. And of course, in most of the races, it was the communists who were the second best chance to beat United Russia. And of course, insofar as they discuss the Communist Party in the West, they say, oh, well, it's just controlled by Putin. At the same time, that's just wrong, because, for example, the Communist Party opposed Putin's revision of the constitution, which allowed him to be re-elected as president.
You know, look, they don't really talk about it on RT either, do they? You don't hear.
Well, no, all right, but I'm just pointing out that
because
the
RT is really a mouthpiece for United Russia.
I would disagree with that. They do occasionally mention the communists, but you certainly don't get them mentioned. You see, this is the whole delusion that all of this is Putin's evil machination. He is basically primus inter pares in a very complex political system, which has evolved since the changes of 1990s. And the Communist Party put down a resolution saying the government should recognize the breakaway republics of Donetsk and Luhansk. And because United Russia realized that they put down a resolution, they put down a resolution saying the same thing. The difference between the Communist resolution and the United Russia resolution was that the Communist resolution was going to be binding and would go directly to Putin. The United Russia resolution, because they didn't want to bind Putin's hands, was it would go to the foreign ministry to be discussed. But when it came to the voting in the parliament, the Communist resolution passed, which basically it doesn't bind. I mean, what Maria Zakharova and others from the foreign ministry were saying after this resolution was passed is that we take note of what the parliament has said, but just like in the US system, the parliament doesn't control, the Congress doesn't control foreign policy directly. So we've taken note of this, but we're not necessarily going to implement it because we're not obliged to. And of course, the policy has always been since 2014 that what the Russian foreign policy goal was to have independent republics in Donetsk and Luhansk, which are autonomous regions within Ukraine. And the reason why they wanted that is because as autonomous regions within Ukraine, a bit like Kosovo used to be an autonomous region within Serbia, which was only created in the 1970s by Tito, but that's a bit of a red herring, is that they could veto access to NATO. Yeah, so they wanted to keep them in the Ukraine as a means of preventing Ukraine coming into NATO. Now, because of the refusal of the West to negotiate about this, or rather the refusal of the regime in Kiev to negotiate about this, partly because they're under pressure from the extreme right, who just don't accept any kind of compromise, and partly because the British and the Americans told Zelensky, we don't want you to compromise about this. So he didn't. And the Russians eventually, after all this time, have decided, no, in that case, what we could have done in the first place, we are going to recognise the referendums that were held in 2014 in Donetsk and Luhansk, and we're going to recognise them as independent republics. Now, in the Security Council meeting that was televised, one of the Russian people there said, and they can be part of the Russian Federation. But Putin immediately interrupted him and said, no, we'll recognize them as independent republics, not necessarily as part of the Russian Federation. So in actual fact, the Russian side on the issue of what's going to happen in East Ukraine have been putting forward a compromise position all along. But eventually, of course, politics in Russia itself has forced them into a more proactive stance. And once they'd passed this, And the final recognition that the resolution went to the presidential level, and then when the president Putin said we're going to recognize them, it then had to be ratified in the Duma, the Russian parliament, and that was unanimous. Yeah, there was 16 votes against when the original resolution was put up. I tried to find out who the 16 deputies were that had voted against it, but anyway, when it came back, after Putin had recognized the republics and they had to ratify it, it was unanimous. Now, this is what is not coming across at all in Western media presentation of this, which is Russian public opinion. Yeah. Russian public opinion is actually quite concerned about what's going on in East Ukraine. But I'll bet you most people in Bristol, until this all blew up, weren't really thinking of Ukraine as the top of the things that they needed to worry about. Yeah. And I think this is the difference between, you know, there's a kind of lazy attitude towards all of this, as if this is all being made up by Putin.
Try and get inside Putin's head a little bit. It seems to me, Martin, what you're saying is what he's trying to do is he can see that it makes military sense to, for example, to have Russian troops in Ukraine, in those provinces, backing those guys up. But he can see the political reasons for doing it. It's better to hang back, look at the situation as it develops, as more and more people see that that is going to have to be a necessity. And once there's maybe, you know, a larger majority or a majority of some sort of people can see that he's actually been very restrained so far, then is the time to move, when he knows that he's got public opinion on his side.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Russian government is saying to the Russian people, look, we bent over backwards to try and find a compromise here. And this has not been picked up in the West at all, because what they could have done in 2014, they recognized Crimean independence immediately. But don't forget, Crimea was only bundled into the Ukraine in 1954 because Khrushchev had too much vodka. And the Ukraine as a state basically is a creation of Soviet bureaucrats. The same thing happened in Yugoslavia. People are going to war for lines on a map that were drawn up by communist bureaucrats. So there isn't actually any history there. There's always been something there. Obviously, there's been political arrangements in this part of the world, but they were always pretty complicated because it's actually a very flat place. You know, there's not many mountains and everything. And you've got a number of different ethnic groups who are intermingled living there. Yeah. Okay. The Ukrainian speakers are all concentrated in Western countries.
About what's actually going on the ground. It's not easy, obviously, to tell. I was looking at South Front, for example, yesterday. They do a pretty reasonable job in the South Front website in mapping what's going on. But the Daily Mail have also done, which was linked by Andrew Kuripko, they've done a pretty reasonable map. And I'll just run around some of the parts of Ukraine and what apparently has been going on there. So over in the west, in Ivano-Frankivsk, we've had missile strikes there, missile strikes in Lviv, in Kiev again, missile strikes and attacking the Ukraine military headquarters yesterday. Russian helicopters in the north attacking around a place called Hostomel near Kiev. In Chernobyl's been immediately taken over by Russian ground forces. Also in the north, Russia is launching missile strikes and gunfire is heard in Borsipil Airport. So it does seem, and that's just the west and the north, Martin, it does seem as if strategic areas. So, for example, where Western weapons may be being flown in, where special forces may be being flown in and out of Ukraine, these are the places they seem to be hitting. And obviously Chernobyl, which is, that one, it did amaze me that the President Zelenko, he actually said, didn't he, on Wednesday, he said, oh, well, we might have to...
Zelensky.
He actually said we may need nuclear weapons again. So they're not going to get the nuclear weapons because Russian troops are already surrounding the Chernobyl, which is their nuclear facility.
All right. Well, let me give you my assessment of the military situation. Originally, once they'd recognised the two republics, don't forget that they only control less than half the territory which actually voted for independence. The other half of the territory was taken back by force, by the Ukrainian military, backed by the Azov battalion and other radical paramilitary right-wing groups. 14,000 people have already died in this conflict, overwhelmingly civilians from Donetsk and Luhansk. This isn't coming across in the Western media, is it?
Killed by who?
Killed by the Ukrainian military. Some of them have just been killed by shells and by fighting. And some of them have been deliberately killed and put in mass graves, just like in Yugoslavia. The situation in Ukraine is many ways similar to what happened in Yugoslavia in the 1990s when I was an aid worker. You've got the same divisions in the society. Different, it's orthodox versus, you know, it was Orthodox versus Catholic versus Muslim. This is a bit different, different ethnicities, but the hostilities are still there, and they go back to World War II and before World War II. Yeah, the Azov battalion models itself on the irregular forces that fought for the Germans and also helped to cleanse, you know, the Ukraine of Jews, etc., etc. Okay, so that's another thing that, you know, they're gone, but they keep calling them Nazis. They are Nazis. They hold a Nazi ideology. I mean, the Daily Mail, I sent you this the other week, was boasting about this woman who carried out sniper attacks in the Ukraine and saying what a brave heroine she was. And it turns out she's got openly, if you look at her Facebook pages, openly pro Adolf Hitler Nazi views. Yeah, she has. And of course, when these people get hold of what they regard as Russian Moscows, as they call them, or they kill them. Yeah. And of course, that's just, you know, there's been an awful lot of that going on. And of course, there were three major assassinations in Donetsk and Luhansk of Givi and Motorola, who were paramilitary leaders, and Zakhachenko, who was a political figure. They were all killed by car bombs. And those car bombs were planted by Ukrainian special forces who were trained by our special forces.
Well, that's funny, isn't it? Because this is exactly why, at the end of 2021, the Russian government came to the West and they said, we need to have a security agreement here. Yeah. I mean,
I just want to get to a further point.
Yeah, all right, go on.
What I thought they might do, having recognised the republics, is just send the Russian army over the border to reinforce the Donetsk and Luhansk militias. OK, so that way the you create a tripwire force. Yeah, because they've got 100,000 troops on the other side. The Donetsk and Luhansk force has got about 30,000. So if the Russian army came in with its kit and just stood next to them, that might be enough to deter them coming in. And then I thought, well, what they might do, having done that, don't forget, by recognizing the whole of the oblasts which voted for independence, they basically then say, now you've got to withdraw, because the people that you're, you know, because most of the people where they're occupying voted for independence. Are you following what I'm saying here? It's a bit like how Yugoslavia.
I mean, when you say they are occupying, it's not unclear who you mean. The Ukrainians are occupying an area of people that voted to leave Ukraine.
Yes. So the fighting on the front line, still wherever the shells fall on civilians, is killing civilians who probably voted to leave the Ukraine. Are you following me? Yeah. So anyway, yeah, what they could have done is then push them back. If they refused to go back, they could have pushed them back. But I think, having looked at the military, you know, from a military point of view, that's asking too much of the militias, which have basically held the line in East Ukraine for the last 8 years. They've taken the brunt of the fighting. They've lost most of the people. And it's not fair, really, that these irregular people should have to do the fighting. So what they've done is they decided, well, the obvious thing that I thought what they then might do, and they are doing, in fact, is they invade and create a pincer movement behind the Ukrainian forces, so to put them into a cauldron. And that is actually happening as we speak, you know. That is happening. They're coming in from the north, they're coming in from the south, and they're creating a cauldron to keep the bulk of the Ukrainian army in that cauldron. And of course, many of them are conscripts, and they just say to them, right, put down your weapons and go home, and we will then, you know, take over the whole of Donetsk and Luhansk. But if you're going to go to war with the whole Ukrainian army, why just go to war with the front line of the army? You've got to go to war with the whole infrastructure of the army. When we invaded Europe on D-Day, we were still bombing Germany at the same time, weren't we? We didn't just say, well, we'll deal with Germany when we get there. And of course, if you're going to fight somebody, that's what you do. You don't just go up and say, well, let's go and have a fight over here in the corner. You get behind them. So okay, well, I thought if they'd just done that, then you say, right, OK. But if you're going to do that, the logic is quite clear. If you're going to do that, you've actually got to attack the command and control headquarters, which is in Kiev. Now, what Putin is saying is, we're not intending to occupy the whole Ukraine. Once we've liberated Donetsk and Luhansk, we're probably going home. Now, that is exactly what happened in Georgia in 2008, because Shakashvili, who's also implicated in the crisis in Ukraine, because he looks as if he's behind the Maidan snipers. That's another story. But they attacked Abkhazia and South Ossetia, which had broken away, and killed Russian peacekeepers who were there to keep the two sides apart. And the Russian army then just drove them back and drove them all the way back to Tbilisi, which is the capital, and then withdrew back into, you know, don't do that again. Now, I think what the military goal here is probably more ambitious, because they want Donetsk and Luhansk to be completely independent. But there's also other chunks of Ukraine which they think probably want independence as well. And I think if you look at where they're going, that Ukraine, if you look at the political map of it before all this kicked in, the more right-wing pro-Ukrainian forces are all in the West Ukraine. And there's a pretty clear line, if you look at the electoral map, like in Northern Ireland, on one side, people voted for independent Ukraine, you know, leaving, you know, they supported the overthrow of Yanukovych, they're pro-Western, all the rest of it. But in the East Ukraine, that just isn't the case. And that includes most of the areas which are close to the Black Sea coast. And that all that runs up to what is now Transnistria, which is a sliver of pro-Russian territory up the Dniester River between Moldova and the rest of the Ukraine. Now, in other words, what we're talking about here is very similar to the kind of things we used to talk about in Yugoslavia in the 90s when I was an aid worker there. Who controls the B-hatch pocket? Where are the Croatians trying to link up with where are the Croatians trying to link up here? And it's to do with history. I mean, in Ukraine, I had Croatians arguing me that we used to control this area in the 10th century. I said, but it's part of Bosnia. Yeah, but that was just the communists saying that. It used to be ours in the 10th century. Now, this is the kind of level at which the debate can be conducted if you're not careful. But anyway, I think also the other thing is, on the Russian side, just to finish, is whatever they did, they were going to be accused of everything anyway, and sanctions were going to be imposed on them, whatever they did. And if you're going to be accused of anything anyway, you might as well go for broke. We're going to change the regime in Kiev, and we're going to liberate Donetsk and Luhansk and probably other regions like Odessa, for example. That was mentioned in Putin's speech because of a big massacre in Odessa by the Azov battalion and their allies at the very beginning of the crisis, which the West has completely ignored. I mean, these people are all burned to death. Nobody's been punished for it. The reason being, of course, that they're working closely with MI6, CIA and other groups of murderers and terrorists, the sort of people that people in Northern Ireland know exactly who they are, but less so in Bath and Wells.
Do you think they're more maybe likely to face justice now, some of these people?
I think the intention is to capture as many of them as alive as possible and put them on trial. I think that's what the intention is. Because, of course, probably the Ukrainians that shot down MH17, Paribi. Now, if they can get hold of Paribi and put him on trial with all the evidence and everything, you know, that's the way the Russians are thinking.
Yeah, well, I guess these people will be scooting out of the country.
Well, that's what a lot of them have. Didn't you see that they all somebody knew what was going on, because a lot of people got on planes and disappeared to the West.
Well, that's a bit of a dangerous thing to do in a Russian no-fly zone.
Well, no, that's the ones who got out. You see, nobody can go in and out now. So anybody who's still there now will have to leave by car or on foot. But quite a few of them got the pro-Western oligarchs who knew that they might be in the firing line. I don't know where Kolomoisky is, who's Zelensky's Krisha, as they say in Russian, his roof, his support, you know, the guy who made him. But of course, the other things that's been going on in Ukraine is various television stations, which have got vaguely pro-Russian views, have been banned. Yeah, I mean, people presume that Ukraine's a democracy. It's not. It's a very, very, failed state. And Russia is far more democratic. Russia is far more democratic than the US.
There is an extent
where people get less votes end up being in power.
Yeah, there is an extent here, Martin, where many Ukrainians must feel, we've been kind of hung out to dry here.
Oh, yes. Well, Zelensky has said that himself, you know. I mean, the Russians fought Zelensky might be, I mean, it's one of the reasons why they've held back for so long, because Poroshenko is basically a knuckle-dragging, let's go to war now person. And Poroshenko pretty decisively lost the last presidential election in Ukraine. And Zelensky promised a new start. He said, you know, we're not going to waste too much time on all this old historical stuff, because what people really want is jobs and a future. And that, you know, retaking the East Ukraine isn't really the priority, is it? But the problem for him is that the right wing don't accept that. They're a bit like the old IRA. They don't accept the existence of the state. If we're not going to get the bits back that we've lost, then you've lost legitimacy. And our legitimacy doesn't depend upon whether you've got more votes than us. Mm. Poroshenko was expelled eventually from Ukraine, but because he was accused of corruption. He came back and Zelensky was going to put him on trial for corruption. But then Poroshenko wasn't able to be put on trial for corruption because he's protected by the West. And the West's role in all of this has been to encourage the most militant and reactionary elements in Ukrainian politics rather than the middle of the road people like Zelensky. And they've undermined Zelensky completely. Okay, and of course, he's blowing around in the wind like a flag. I mean, yesterday he was saying, I am prepared to negotiate with the Russians about not joining NATO. And the Russians are saying, well, I'm glad to hear that, but it's a bit late.
Yeah. Well, it's not too late, is it? Of course, it's
not. Hopefully not. I mean, this whole thing, I mean, the best outcome now, as far as I can see, is if it's all dealt with very, very quickly. I mean, the whole business in Georgia in 2008 was over in 2 weeks. And then, you know, you've got a new situation and a different, you know, Saakashvili lost power in Georgia ultimately, but he wasn't removed by the Russians. He was removed by his own people who thought he completely misjudged the situation and brought them into a disaster. No, and I mean, then, of course, he was accused of corruption in Georgia, and he came over and was put in place as a governor of the Odessa province in Ukraine by the Western powers, that's to say by people like our people put him in power he's not even a Ukrainian national. And then he got accused of corruption and got driven out of the Ukraine. But the Maidan snipers who testified from Georgia that they were the snipers, they said that it was orchestrated by Saakashvili. And Saakashvili, of course, is on the MI6's list of one of our guys. And of course, in Russia itself, educated people know all of this stuff. Ordinary people just know that the attitude of the West towards us is totally contemptuous. But educated people know all this detail. But we don't know all this detail.
Most people in the West don't know all this detail. Nobody tells them. But look, you know as well as I do the glee with which the Americans noted the Russian invasion in the 80s of Afghanistan. Do you think that there may be, that Putin has been kind of lured into Ukraine?
Well, I think the calculation for the Russians is that they perceive, rightly or wrongly, they perceive political developments in Ukraine as so serious that they've got to do something about it. But they do realise that, for example, I think they've probably written off the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. I mean, the events of this week means that it will never be switched on. And it was probably not going to be switched on anyway. So to some extent, this is a victory for the Americans and their British poodles. They're the ones who didn't want it switched on. The Germans and the French wanted it switched on, but they've been sidelined. And of course, the Normandy 4 agreements was between Germany, France, Ukraine and Russia. The Americans and the British weren't involved in the Minsk agreements. And of course, the Minsk agreements could be reactivated if the attitude was right on the Ukrainian side, the German side and the French side. And that's what I think the decision to invade Ukraine or to carry out the military operation, whatever you want to call it, was only made when it became clear that the French and the Germans weren't willing to pressurize the Ukrainians to negotiate with the Donbass republics. They just weren't willing to push them. And of course, they were being pushed themselves by the Americans and the British not to do that. Britain has played a particularly a particularly nefarious role in this crisis, perfidious Albion. And don't forget, our special forces were probably behind the assassinations of the Zakhachenko, who was a political leader in the DPR. Now, of course, they could, like in the bad old days in Ireland, have just retaliated by going into Ukraine and killing equivalent people on the other side. But if they'd done that, they would have been terrorists, wouldn't they? So this is the double standard that's constantly being used. And of course, you know, it doesn't take a genius to recognize that countries which invade Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, Iraq, you know, these people are not really in a position to start throwing stones, are they?
Well, I put it to you that the Americans don't really care that much, or neither does the UK, EU, about Ukraine. No. They see this as a great propaganda victory for them.
Yes, I think the EU is hardly mentioned. I mean, the EU is not really a player in all this. I mean, they exist and they've supposedly got a view, but in actual fact, it's individual European countries who've got different views. You see, the Greeks, the Cypriots, and so on, do not want to remove Russia from the SWIFT system, nor do the Germans. But the British are keen on it because that's what the Americans want. And we always do what they want. So, the downside for the Russians of all of this is that there's going to be a huge, outrageous, you know, how dare you sort of chorus coming from to the point where you'll be shouted down if you say anything complicated about it. They knew that, but I think they made the calculation that if they were going to get that anyway, doesn't matter what we do.
Mm.
It's a bit like the Irish Republican movement back in the days of the war. We're going to get lectured all about everything we do, whatever we do. So, you know, it's got to be water off a duck's back.
Well, I suppose they don't really care too much about public opinion in the West when their own existence as a nation.
Yeah, they've got their own.
Martin, please just let me finish. But their own existence as a nation is under threat. Do you think that Putin was exaggerating yesterday, the day that the Russian troops went into Ukraine, when he said that actually it's a matter of life and death for Russia as a nation?
Well, I think that sort of rhetoric makes him sound in the West as if he's a nutter. But of course, it's not necessarily the case that he, nuclear war threats are pretty serious. If the Russians were to put nuclear missiles in Cuba, would that be acceptable to the Democrats and the Republicans in the United States of America? Anybody can put missiles anywhere they like? The answer is no, it wouldn't. I'm just saying we've already had these deals with you going back to the 1960s when we both nearly blew the world up. Why are you ripping them all up and pushing these short range nuclear missiles in our face? What is the we're bound to react to that at some point. You know, we're trying to be nice with you and say, well, I mean, you told us that you put them there because you're trying to prevent the Iranians from attacking Europe. And then even at the time, that was ridiculous. And of course, the idea that you can get away with coming out with stuff like that when the Russians know these are pointed at us. Of course, they are. They're not pointed at the Iranians.
But Martin, this demonization of Putin and Russia, I mean, it's a drip, drip, drip effect over, you know, many years, decades even, really since the split with the G7 or, you know, so it used to be the G8 with Russia and there was a split there. They decided, no, they're no longer going to be part of that. And Russia made it clear it's not going to be playing ball with the Western economies. The drip drip effect is that actually you end up with Russia being turned into an enemy, even if it isn't.
Well, that's right. It wasn't the Russians who resigned from the G8. They were kicked out. And at one stage, when Putin first came to power, he was suggesting, he said to George Robertson at a meeting, when do we join NATO? And George Robertson said, well, you don't. You have to make an application first. What the Russians were putting forward in this document that came out in December is we need an architecture for security in Europe, which protects our interests and your interests. And we need a full comprehensive treaty so that we get, you know, you take nuclear missiles out of our face and we will guarantee that we won't have short range missiles either so that we can't start something. And these are agreements that have already been made between Gorbachev and Reagan. When there was no democracy in the USSR, not direct democracy anyway. But you're perfectly happy to deal with us when we were a gangster state. But now we've got some kind of democracy. You don't want to talk to us. It's ridiculous. It is absurd. And you can see educated Russians are frustrated. Why are we being treated like this?
Yeah, so I think maybe we can go and have a listen to. Well, I mean, I'm extremely disillusioned with our democracy in Britain, particularly in Bristol. Our MPs don't even bother to reply if I send emails or letters in the post, recorded delivery, signed for, as they call it nowadays. They don't even bother to reply. So these are Labour MPs. The one I've been writing to with it, rather, I think, important information we've covered on this programme about the failure of the supply chain of the manufacture of these COVID jabs, put together by the Welsh guy we had on a few weeks ago, I thought, well, let's see, you know, if our MP is even interested in this, because it proves that the regulations on the safety of medicines are not working in this country, and not even a reply. So these MPs, I think, are basically useless. They go along with whatever Keir Starmer says, these Labour MPs. I think we've got one Tory MP who's probably not much better. And so this seems to me that the effect of all of this, of course, is to just discredit the democratic system. Another system, when it comes along, people will welcome with open arms, even if it is a fascist system, it seems, dressed up as something else. So let's have a listen now to one of our local MPs, Bristol East MP, Kerry McCarthy, because she was on ITV last night talking about her reaction to the sanctions being imposed after we heard of the invasion by Russia of Ukraine.
I think we do need stronger sanctions. Partly because of the UK's position, London's position, as the sort of world's largest financial trading centre, we have inordinate power, if you like. Yeah, we have more influence than many other countries in terms of the economic impact we would have. And we know that London in particular has become a haven for Russian oligarchs and kleptocrats and people. You know, there's a huge concern about them buying up London, but also using us as a money laundering base. So there's all issues beyond immediate sanctions, question about golden visas that have been offered to Russians to come to this country. We need to act on all those fronts. Whether it will have an impact, I think some way down the line you would hope that the economic impact and just the pressure from Putin's circle, and as I said, you know, the people who are close to him who've got assets in the UK, I would hope that would help.
Bristol East MP Kerry McCarthy there with her take on the sanctions, Martin.
Well, I mean, what can I say about this? The sanctions that you've got to remember that most of the oligarchs who keep their money in Britain are not necessarily pro-Putin at all. I mean, did you see, I can't remember his name, it's James Cleverly, that's right, because he was being questioned about this, and he was, because a lot of them have given loads of money to the Tory party. And he said, well, the Russians who've got dual nationality, you know, British and Russian, they didn't want to see Jeremy Corbyn in Downing Street. And that's why they gave us a load of money at the last election. And you can imagine that the kind of oligarchs that didn't want Jeremy Corbyn in Downing Street, they're not necessarily pro-Putin at all. They're not necessarily anti-Putin either. They're just on their own side. Now, in actual fact, the fact that London has become a money laundering, not just for Russian oligarchs. What about the Saudi guy we were talking about last week? A prince who was going to get British citizenship and a knighthood as long as he gave some money to one of Prince Charles's little projects. This is the country we live in, where we turn back genuine refugees walk in as long as they got their pocketbook open.
Just to be clear, he did get it. He did get the passport and he did get the...
Well, indeed. So, in other words, if we're going to close down London as a money laundry, I'm totally in favour of that. But of course, it's got implications for tax, for all sorts of things, if you're going to do that. The other point I'd make about this, from the Russian government point of view, if their oligarchs are forced to take their money out of London and put it back in the Moscow Stock Exchange, then that's good news for Russia, and they don't. It's not a threat that they're going to worry about. There's a delusion in the West that Putin is controlled by the oligarchs, and therefore if their assets are hit, they will then try and get rid of Putin, which is exactly what Berezovsky was. Berezovsky was an oligarch who controlled NTV, and they thought that they could control Putin. And Putin basically, when he came to power, said, no, I'm actually, he's what's called the Siloviki's from the security structure. They're not basically, didn't make their money out of privatisation and so on. And Berezovsky and Putin fell out. And Berezovsky, of course, came to live in Britain and then supposedly committed suicide in Surrey, although the coroner in Surrey refused to sign it off as suicide. And Berezovsky's daughter thinks he was murdered not by the Russians, but by the British. Now, I don't suppose Kerry McCarthy knows anything about any of this. She's been given a briefing paper about this by her researchers, and she's been given the, a labor internal labor report back. This is the line we're going to take on this. But if you were to ask her a direct question, what do you know about Boris Berezovsky? She might very well say, who? And of course, the Russians roll their eyes. You've no idea, you know, the level of knowledge of the actual workings of Russian politics is pretty pitiful.
I think it also that this all this stuff about sanctions, to me, this is obviously the Ukrainians themselves who are just they can't believe that the West has just abandoned them like this and left them to their fate, are thinking, well, you know, this isn't a very good thing to have just left us here with no real. You've given us a few anti-tank guns, but, you know, that's not going to defeat the Russian army. And the West's attitude does seem to be, we need to just use money to that's our main weapon, economic warfare of one sort or another. And the idea is that, you know, you can actually defeat your enemies by depriving them of a living, whether that be through court cases, whether that be through simply theft or whatever. But they seem to have this kind of finance mentality where money is everything, and by taking people's money away, you're going to win. But I don't know if that's really the case with Russia.
Well, it's not really the case in general. You know, in repressive regimes, you know, if you put sanctions on the country as a whole, in order to try and force the population to rise up, are, you know, it's a pretty, you know, if you think about it, it's a pretty ridiculous way to proceed, isn't it? Why should the people who have been repressed by the repressive regime be given even more desperate circumstances in the hopes that they will rise up? That is, you know, it's very unlikely that they will rise up, and just strengthens the oligarchs who are in control. And B, it's basically using them instrumentally, isn't it? Now, of course, a country like Israel, which claims to be a democracy, if you were to cut off their welfare payments, they might decide to vote against the government that had dragged them into the mess. But in countries where they have no democracy, that wouldn't happen, would it? But in any case, Russia is a relatively democratic country, but the oligarchs do not control Putin's policy. And there's a misunderstanding here. That what happened in the 1990s when the oligarchs took control in Russia, they used to call about the nine oligarchs who controlled everything in Russia. That was a time when the West had its little protege in power, Boris Yeltsin, who shelled the Russian parliament, killing hundreds of people because the parliament didn't want to carry out privatizations, which we insisted on. And instead of saying, gosh, this is awfully shelling the parliament, we said, great, thank goodness for Yeltsin stopping the communist deputies in the parliament from preventing privatization, because we all know privatization is the road to prosperity and freedom. Now, the knowledge of recent Russian history, I have to say, I mean, obviously, I was a bit of an expert because I used to work over there and I used to work for aid agencies and the New Economics Foundation. But the level of knowledge of what really went on in that era in the political classes in this country, never mind the ordinary population, is pitiful. And of course, what you've always got is this, Putin fulfills this perfectly, this idea of the Russians as congenitally evil and, you know, they're always plotting, they're just naturally authoritarian and all the rest of it. So you go to nitty-gritty
detail. I don't know quite how that fits in with their equalities agendas and things like that. It doesn't really sound very good, does it? Look, we had a programme on last night on Channel 4, late, I think it was 11 till 12 or something like that, which seemed almost perfectly timed. It was a biopic about Vladimir Putin's rise to power. And it showed, you know, him taking over. It actually showed the Moscow and Ryazan bombings, and it showed you know, his role in that, which was you know, condemn the Chechens who were supposed to have been behind it. It also showed that they discovered a whole load of what they thought were explosives under a Ryazan block of flats about to be blown up potentially. Yep. Planted by the actual FSB itself that Putin was had previously been the head of, which is, you know, extremely suspect. And then they showed a picture of Boris Yeltsin phoning Putin to congratulate him on the night of the election when it was announced that he'd won, and then having to wait and wait, and he never got a call back. And that was the last time apparently Putin had anything to do with him, even though he'd been a big supporter of Putin and tried to get people to vote for him. So it was sort of showing this transition of Putin coming to power in 2000 as quite a mean guy. But you mentioned Berezovsky earlier. He had a big role in Putin taking over, didn't he?
That's right. What happened was...
I'm just pointing out, Martin, that Berezovsky wasn't even mentioned in this. I think maybe once saying that he owned the NTV TV channel.
Yeah, well, what was actually happening in 1998 was... it was the 90s was when I was working in Eastern Europe. I was going all over the place. And in every single country in Eastern Europe, at the second election, at the first election, there used to be pro-Western people won. It was all very naive and people were trying to work out where they were going with the various societies and countries. And, you know, people who were not the communists won in every country. Yeah, apart from in Bulgaria, where the Bulgarian Socialist Party, which was the reformed Communist Party, won the first election. In every other part of Eastern Europe, the communists lost the first election, but they all won the second election once the privatization IMF agenda had been revealed. And what was happening, the opinion polls were showing that Zyuganov of the Communist Party was set fair to win the 1998 Russian presidential election, and that set alarm bells ringing in the hierarchy, in the oligarchy, and the senior oligarch was Berezovsky, and Berezovsky basically told Yeltsin, "Don't worry, we'll fix this for you," because he needed to win in the first round with 50% plus of the vote, so there wouldn't be a second round, and then this is why all of this happened. And Putin may or may not have been involved. When he first appeared, I thought he is basically a Western hitman, a Western gangster. But it turned out that he wasn't, that in actual fact, he disciplined the oligarchy. And so, he kept the communists out for them. But he said, right, you know, we kept the communists out for you, but now we're going to put you in order. We're not having a situation where you determine the political priorities of the country. Khodorkovsky, who ended up going to prison, was about to give away Russia's oil and gas industry to foreign interests, particularly Israeli interests. And the Siloviki, which is the security state where Putin came from, you know, KGB and all the rest of it, were saying, no, hang on a minute, that's against Russia's national interest. And of course, the Russians have still got a nationalized gas and oil industry. We used to have one. What happened to that? You're not allowed to have those anymore. But of course, in actual fact, they're an essential feature of countries which want to have an independent policy on anything.
Well, maybe the fact that so many countries now no longer have that is being one of the major forces towards a world government or globalization.
Well, that's right. I mean, this has been an issue going back to the 1950s when Mossadegh was overthrown in Iran for nationalising British Petroleum. I mean, it was called British Petroleum because it was owned by the British and it wasn't owned by the Iranians. And he nationalised it and said, this is our oil. We want the money from it. So we, with the Americans, overthrew him and imposed the Shah, who was a dictator. But at least they didn't have a nationalised oil industry. They've got one now. But it took a revolution.
Anyway, I think we should go and have a listen now to the second clip. We've got a few with Kerry McCarthy, our local Bristol East MP, who did actually manage to find a television studio, ITV, yesterday evening, where she would able to react to yesterday's invasion of Ukraine by Russia ITV Politics West, I think they call it. I'm not sure what they call it. But anyway, she was asked by the presenter, does she think that Putin is someone you can negotiate with? But before we hear the clip, I wonder, Martin, whether you think he is.
I would say that Putin is the elected head of state of Russia and you have to negotiate with him. We've probably got to negotiate with MBS, who is the prince in charge in Saudi Arabia. Nobody voted for him, but he's the chief. And you've got to negotiate wherever the chief is, because that's what you've got to do.
Yeah, but I think there's a lot of people that say that it's him that's not negotiating. This does seem to me to be a bit like a kind of mental illness in the West here, where actually Putin is holding out this olive branch saying, hey, do you want security in Eastern Europe last December with these treaties to NATO, to the United States, saying, come on, let's set some hotlines up in case there are flare-ups in these areas because we've got none of these treaties that we used to have anymore. That sounds to me like someone you can negotiate with, and yet they have refused to negotiate with him, and yet we're being told that Putin is someone that you can't negotiate with. So let's have a listen now to our second clip with our local Bristol MP Kerry McCarthy, where she talks about, can you negotiate with Vladimir Putin?
Saying to Putin, you know, you withdraw your troops or else. I just don't think Putin's psyche, you know, he's such a macho leader, and there's just a very Russian attitude of sort of belligerence and, you know, swearing black is white. We saw with the Salisbury poisoning when the guys were interviewed and, you know, we went to look at the spire, you know, of the cathedral or whatever. So I don't think Putin would respond to those threats. I think you actually need the actuality of the sanctions to bite before, you know, and even then, you know, that pride that he has and the machismo, I think I can't really see him backing down. But then you get into a situation where everything becomes out of hand, because if there's that ego behind it, you're not looking at rational decisions.
So Putin is irrational. He's not the kind of guy you can negotiate with at all, Martin.
Well, if there was another election in Russia tomorrow, he'd probably win it. But let's say he lost the election in Russia. Who would win the election to be president of Russia is pretty clear. And it was clear in 1998 it was going to be Gennady Zyuganov, who was the head of the Communist Party of Russia. Now, the Communist Party of Russia have, in fact, got a harder line on Ukraine than Putin, as has Zhirinovsky, who represents the right wing in Russian politics. He's got a harder line. You know, Putin is, in fact, a moderate in Russian terms, in terms of his attitude towards the West. So, for example, he's been under pressure all along to recognise the breakaway republics in the Ukraine. And he said, no, I'm not doing that, because I think it's too provocative to the West. We'll have to play it softly.
I mean, OK, so why is our MP there, Kerry McCarthy, saying he's not the kind of guy that we can negotiate with, when actually he is, and he is holding out the olive branch. He's trying to negotiate, and it's the British who are saying no.
I think it's because the West, don't forget, Kerry McCarthy is a fairly low-level opposition MP in Britain. And they're basically the propaganda. She mentioned the Skripal poisoning there. To my mind, the overwhelming evidence behind that is that this is an MI6 operation, the whole thing. It's not a Russian operation at all. And the reason why MI6 and Brigade 77 and all of the other secret spooks that carry out these operations carry them out is so that Kerry McCarthy has given a little crib script. Oh, well, he carried out the poisonings in Salisbury. Now, this is what all of these operations are about. It's Operation Beluga.
What evidence have you got for that? Most people think the Russians did carry out the Salisbury attack.
We covered an awful lot of this at the time, Tony. I'll try to just cut to the chase by mentioning Paul Birrell, B-R-E-L-L, who was a top anti-terrorist officer in the French police. And at the time of Skripal and at the time of other things, he said, and he used to be in Berezovsky's security detail. He says the Western intelligence services, MI6, CIA, DGSC, they have got something called Operation Beluga, B-E-L-U-G-A. And that is, whenever possible, we're going to set up what are essentially intelligence service operations which will sabotage constructive relations between Russia and the West. And they do this so that the politicians at a lower level of the food chain, then if they were to say, look at what happened to Jeremy Corbyn. You remember him, the beardy one? He said at the time, we've got to see some evidence about whether the Russians did this or not. And everybody's screaming, but the evidence is there. The evidence isn't there. In actual fact, if it was Novichok poisoning in Salisbury, everybody in Salisbury would be dead. So it can't clearly be Novichok. It must be something else, mustn't it? And well, of course, they use a term, Novichok, because it sounds Russian.
This nerve gas, whatever it is, nerve agent stuff. One of the people with the perfume bottle apparently got it all over their hands. They didn't die. Then it was sprayed at various people. They didn't die. It doesn't sound to me like a deadly nerve agent was even involved in all of this.
Whatever it is, it's certainly not Novichok. And the problem is, you see, people. I know Kerry McCarthy. I haven't spoken to her for a long time, but I do know her. And if you're going to be an MP, an awful lot of your time is you've got to do, you know, it's very, very time consuming. You know, your life is taken over completely and you are constantly being given little briefing notes about what stuff you're supposed to know about.
I mean, I think she gets face-to-face briefings with the security services.
Well, she may get face-to-face briefings, but the problem is she doesn't get any time to research anything. You don't get. I mean, I spoke to Steve Webb when he was my MP, Liberal MP, for South Gloucestershire, and I went to talk to him about various things, Columbia and various other things, and he said to me, "Well, this is all very interesting, but you'll understand that I don't get any time to read a book. I haven't read a book since I became an MP. I don't get time to research anything. So all you get is this kind of crib sheet. Putin can't negotiate with him. Skripal.
It's
just a series of notes."
There's another thing, isn't there? And it's called groupthink. When if everyone else is thinking it, you don't think. I think it's a bit extraordinary in Parliament this week to see that there hasn't been really a single voice speaking out. Even in the press, only someone like, I would say just, the only one I've seen is Peter Hitchens is the only one that's been pointing out the fact of the Nazis in Ukraine.
Well, that's right. And of course, he is an indulged right-wing columnist. So he's allowed to say stuff. But if Jeremy Corbyn was to say, well, there's a right wing in Ukraine, blah, blah, blah. You remember him, the beardy one? You see how this mind control works.
Yeah,
so you've got the intelligence services creating these incidents, which then create the media.
Ignored. Most likely ignored, Jeremy Corbyn. Anyway, let's go on to another clip from Kerry, because then she gets on to talking about some of the military aspects of what's been going on in Ukraine yesterday and today.
I think in terms of giving military support, which isn't the same as actually NATO troops engaging in Ukraine, and I think at the moment the position is that they're not members of NATO, and therefore we will stick to the sort of general consensus around not intervening in that. But I think we can certainly ought to be given what support we can as MPs have called for, yes.
Well, there you go. I mean, the standard of our MPs, I think, is just, you know, dismal, really. She doesn't really seem to know anything. And I suppose at least she's just trying to put a brave face on it there, Martin, and just go along with whatever she's heard, even though she doesn't really know anything about it.
Yeah, well, you could say, well, I mean, I think it's to be welcomed, and the Ukrainians should have taken notice of this, that no politicians in the West are saying we're going to come and fight for you or with you. Now, we know that British Special Forces have been working with the Azov Battalion and so on, but that's a different matter. And the Russians are aware of that as well. There's what you might call military support, which remains under the radar. OK, but the idea that we're going to encourage the Ukrainians to take a belligerent line and to provoke the Russians, and then when the Russians invade, we go, oh, sorry about that. I mean, people really need to think through this kind of statement. And of course, the Russians could conclude, look, these are what may happen in the next few days is that British SBS or SAS guys are captured by the Russians and then paraded on Russian TV. What are these guys doing here? And of course, what Putin has also said, I mean, did you see David Davis was suggesting that we should put in a no-fly zone over Ukraine? And Putin said, anybody who puts their finger into this, we'll fight back. So, for example, if RAF planes, they won't just shoot down the RAF planes over Ukraine, they will also attack the bases that they came from. And they're making it absolutely clear, don't get involved in this because we'll go to war with you and you won't like it. The problem with people like Kerry McCarthy is and a lot of other warmongers is that they like the idea of...
Martin, she's not warmongering there, is she?
She's saying we won't be
helping them.
All right. Well, let's say David Davis is that they don't understand what you're talking about. There's no military. Scott Ritter, who was the former US Marine colonel and weapons inspector in Iraq. And when I was last on RT last week, I was quoting him saying that NATO has no military options to help Ukraine. Even if NATO decided to go to war with Russia over Ukraine, NATO would lose. The Russians are on their home turf playing a home game. Yeah. Who's going to beat them on their home turf?
Well, maybe just not. Okay,
short of a nuclear war.
Let's move on and have a listen now to the House of Commons rather than ITV West and Prime Minister Boris Johnson himself, where he explained some of the details of the sanctions that the British are now putting on to Russia after the yesterday morning's invasion.
We will set up a new dedicated kleptocracy cell in the National Crime Agency to target sanctions evasion and corrupt Russian assets hidden in the UK, and that means oligarchs in London will have nowhere to hide. And Mr. Speaker, I know that this House will have great interest in the potential of cutting Russia out from SWIFT. And I can confirm, as I've always said, that nothing is off the table. But for all these measures to be successful, it is vital that we have the unity of our partners, the unity in the G7 and other fora. And, Mr. Speaker, Russian investors are already delivering their verdict on the wisdom of Putin's actions. And so far today, Russian stocks are down by as much as 45%. Wiping $250 billion from their value in the biggest one-day decline on record. Sberbank, Russia's biggest lender, is down by as much as 45%, and Gazprom down by as much as 39%, while the ruble has plummeted to record lows against the dollar. We will continue on a remorseless mission to squeeze Russia from the global economy piece by piece, day by day, and week by week. And we will, of course, use Britain's position in every international forum to condemn the onslaught against Ukraine. And we will counter the Kremlin's blizzard of lies and disinformation by telling the truth about Putin's war of choice and his war of aggression. And we will work with our allies on the urgent need to protect other European countries that are not members of NATO and who could become targets of Putin's playbook of subversion and aggression. And we will resist any creeping temptation to accept what Putin is doing today as a fait accompli. There can be no creeping normalisation, not now, not in the months to come, not in the years ahead. We must strengthen NATO's defences still further. And so today I called for a meeting of NATO leaders, which will take place tomorrow, and I will be convening the countries that contribute to the Joint Expeditionary Force, which is led by the United Kingdom and comprises both NATO and non-NATO members. Last Saturday, I warned that this invasion would have global economic consequences, and this morning the oil price has risen strongly. The government will do everything possible to safeguard our own people from the repercussions for the cost of living. And of course, we stand ready to protect our country from any threats, including in cyberspace.
Yes. So, I mean, he's again, you know, saying, well, we're going to make a big fuss about this, but it's all about things like share prices. I wonder whether, you know, is that really going to make a difference if the price of shares of Gazprom goes down? Or that seems to be, you know, they seem to be quite happy with that as a, you know, serious injury to Russia. But surely, you know, these have all been factored in by the Russian military.
Well, obviously, the Russians have factored this in. Otherwise, they wouldn't have done what they've done. Two things. Coming back to what I said earlier, if you drive Russian oligarchs out of London, that's good for Putin. Not bad. They don't seem to grasp this. Yeah, it's not a threat. the Russian government has had a real problem ever since the 1990s that when people make money in Russia, they don't reinvest it in Russia. They take it away and they invest it in football clubs like Chelsea and all the rest of it. And maybe we should relegate Chelsea from the Premier League. That'll make Putin sit up and take some notice, won't it? So this is misconceived in the first instance. Now, the other thing that that Johnson mentioned there was that the oil price has risen. Now, in actual fact, the rise in the oil price means that all the losses on the Russian stock exchange are immediately countered by the gains in Russia's foreign exchange earnings. Now, they say they're going to cut Russia off SWIFT. Now, Rishi Sunak has said that there's a bit of an issue here. And of course, in actual fact, there isn't a consensus to cut Russia off SWIFT. Britain is pushing for it, but Cyprus, Greece and Germany are still resisting this. That is because if you cut Russia off SWIFT, you can't pay them for the gas that they're supplying to Europe, which is what's and then therefore you won't get the gas. And don't forget, if you put sanctions on Russia, they're going to put sanctions on you. They could say, you know about this Nord Stream 2 pipeline? Never mind that. We're going to switch off the existing pipelines because we can counter sanction. The sanctions have been put on Russia since 2014 and the shooting down of MH17. They thought, right, we're going to put sanctions on Russia. We're not going to buy this and we're not going to buy that. And these various people aren't going to, you know, whatever it was. And the Russians said, right, well, we're not buying any of the food from the European Union. Lots of Eastern European countries like the Polish farmers, who I know quite well because I used to live in Poland, they used to sell a lot of their stuff to the Russians.
Okay,
well, and now the Russians just said we're not buying it anymore.
Pretty much demolished Boris's program of sanctions there. Well, is there anything there that is going to actually hurt Russia?
I think what does hurt Russia ultimately is what they want is to have a constructive economic relationship with Western and Eastern Europe, which if you think about the geography, makes perfect sense. There is no reason why Polish farmers shouldn't be able to sell their apples to the Russians, which is what they've done for years. But of course, they can't do that now. And now the Russians have got their own apples. What has actually happened with the sanctions since 2014 is there was an initial hit on the Russian economy. But don't forget, Russia is a very big place. It's a place of the future because it's got all the raw materials you could possibly imagine. Everything, really. And their economic relations with China are developing by leaps and bounds. And the German industrialists want to sell into that market. But if the sanctions regime comes in, they won't be allowed to. So what will actually happen is the politicians in the West, a bit like Brexit, Tony, they're going to find that their sanctions policies are actually going to hurt their own economies more than it hurts the Russians. And at that point, the Russians are just saying, and don't forget, they've got an alternative. We're going to trade with the Chinese. What are you going to do? And well, of course, I mean, the previous Tory government said, well, we're going to trade with the Chinese too. But the Americans said, oh, you can't trade with the Chinese. So the Russians and the Chinese are going to trade and they're going to trade with the Indians. And the question is, what are we going to do? And the answer is, we don't know.
Well,
of course, what gradually happens over time is that the economy shrinks and you have got less resources to do that.
Martin, the answer is that actually our economy is in a terrible state. The Russian economy and the Chinese economy are booming.
That's right, because they're in the development stage of capitalism, where you bring new stuff in and there's all sorts of productivity improvements you can make and changes you can tweak to get things moving fast. The Russian economy has slowed down a bit, as has the Chinese economy, because they're, you know, partly because that's what happens. The more developed your economy becomes, the less room for rapid growth there is. But, you know, people like Jacob Rees-Mogg, the hedge fund manager, know very well that if you want to make money, you've got to invest in China and Russia. Now, if we say we're not going to invest in China and Russia, that's fine. They'll invest in each other, but you won't get a piece of the pie. And then you've got to say, well, what are you going to do exactly? And the answer is Britain is basically a money laundry with a weapons industry attached. That's what it is. That's what it's become. And you know, if you close the money laundry, what else are you going to do?
So let's have a listen to the close of Boris's speech yesterday in the Commons about the sanctions, where he talks about what he sees as this dangerous new Russia that's emerging.
Above all, the House will realise the hard and heavy truth that we now live in a continent where an expansionist power, deploying one of the world's most formidable military machines, is trying to redraw the map of Europe in blood and conquer an independent state by force of arms. And it's vital for the safety of every nation that Putin's squalid venture should ultimately fail and be seen to fail. However long it takes, that will be the steadfast and unflinching goal of the United Kingdom. I hope of every member of this House and every one of our great allies, certain that together we have the power and the will to defend the cause of peace and justice as we have always done. And I say to the people of Russia again, whose president has just authorised an onslaught against a fellow Slavic people, I cannot believe that this horror is being done in your name, or that you really want the pariah status that these actions will bring to the Putin regime. And to our Ukrainian friends, in this moment of agony, I say that we are with you and we are on your side. Your right to choose your own destiny is a right that the United Kingdom and our allies will always defend. And in that spirit, I join you in saying Slava Ukraini, and I commend this statement to the House.
So that's Prime Minister Boris Johnson yesterday talking in a reaction to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Martin, he's painting Russia as a quite a dangerous new force in the world, actually.
Well, it's 1930s reprise time, isn't it? Don't forget, Saddam Hussein was going to destroy us in 45 minutes with his weapons of mass destruction. And Putin is just the latest, you know, whenever we have a conflict with a country, it's 1939 all over again, isn't it? The fact that it's completely different circumstances and there's all sorts of other factors involved doesn't seem to enter into it. And of course, the Russians are pointing, hang on a minute, you invaded Afghanistan. What happened there? You've devastated the place. They're now starving in Afghanistan because we've cut them off. The money that was supposed to be supplied, that's their money, just like we cut the Venezuelans off their own gold. You know, the idea that we're the good guys, the Russians are the bad guys. I mean, I'm not suggesting that they have to like the Russians, but the idea, this is in a way what's happening is the US is very happy here because an Iron Curtain is going up again in Europe, and the Iron Curtain is to stop countries like Germany having a constructive economic relationship with Russia. And from a US point of view, that's very important because cheap Russian gas leads to high quality, low price German products, which can price the Americans out of the international market. Well, so this is what this is all about.
It was Lord Ismay, I think, wasn't it, at the very start of NATO, Martin?
Yes.
That said that the purpose of NATO was to keep Russia out, America in, and Germany down.
That's right, and it's still the purpose of NATO. Now, I think the Russian calculation is they would like to have a constructive economic relationship with Western Europe. And when I first went to the Soviet Union in 1991, they were just, you know, they were very, very pro-Western, the people I spoke to. Very, very pro-West, like everywhere in Eastern Europe and including in Russia itself. They wanted, you know, as much integration with Western Europe as possible. That infatuation is really absolutely over now in Russia. Now, the Russians, in fact, don't need the Germans. The Germans could have got nice, cheap gas from the Russians, which would have helped their economy. If you don't want it, you don't have to have it. The increase in the oil price as a result of the crisis, this is the problem that they've got from the Western strategist's point of view. As the oil price goes up, Russia gets wealthier. So sanctions actually help the Russians to get wealthier. So they're not even really sanctions.
Yeah, you said that. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to Keir Starmer, because after Boris had finished yesterday in the House of Commons, the Labour opposition leader, you would hope, maybe had some different points of view. But no, really, everything, it really is a serious groupthink going on. So let's have a listen now to Starmer on Ukraine replying to Boris yesterday in the Commons.
Keir Starmer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In this dark hour, our thoughts, our solidarity and our resolve are with the Ukrainian people. Invading troops march through their streets. Missiles shell their cities. They've been cast into a war through no fault of their own. Because Putin fears their freedom, And because he knows that no people will choose to live under his bandit rule unless forced to do so at the barrel of a gun. The consequences of Putin's war of aggression will be horrendous and tragic for the people of Ukraine, but also for the Russian people, who've been plunged into chaos by a violent elite, who have stolen their wealth, stolen their chance of democracy, and stolen their future. And we must prepare ourselves for difficulties here. We will face economic pain as we free Europe from dependence on Russian gas and oil and clean our institutions from money stolen from the Russian people.
So that's the current Labour leader, Keir Starmer, speaking in reply to Boris yesterday. Martin, just in the Express, Jeremy Corbyn has actually been, the former leader, has been blaming the UK and the US for provoking Russia. The Daily Mail saying that Keir Starmer is slapping down Jeremy Corbyn over his wrongful attacks on NATO.
Well, I mean, this is more to do with the internal politics of the Labour Party. As you can see, Labour MPs that signed the Stop the War, issued a statement saying that they called on Putin to withdraw his forces from Ukraine. They called for negotiations to be restarted. But they also said that we should withdraw the extension of NATO, because it is pretty obvious that the casus belli underlying all of this is the expansion of NATO after 1991. Don't forget, the British and the Americans promised Gorbachev that if he allowed the reunification of Germany and let Eastern Europe go its own way, that they wouldn't extend NATO one inch eastwards. And there was a big question about that. They said, yes, East Germany can be reunified with West Germany, and they will have to be in NATO, but no other countries will be allowed to go into NATO. And the Russians took their word for it. And of course, they're bitterly regretting that now, because as time went on, it became clear that wasn't going to be the case at all. And NATO wasn't withering on the vine and just becoming a kind of, you know, a talking shop. It was invading the Hindu Kush in Afghanistan. This is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization sent an expeditionary force to Afghanistan, which is about as far from the Atlantic as you can possibly get on the globe.
Anyway, so never mind what his opinions are on Ukraine. Jeremy Corbyn is now being, apparently, it's going to be an extra hurdle to his chances of being reinstated as a Labour MP because he's criticising NATO.
Yes, I mean, he's not criticising NATO. I mean, there's lots of people who think that NATO shouldn't exist or should be disbanded. Jeremy Corbyn has always finessed his position, and I think the obvious position for any reasonable person to take at this point, and even the Ukrainians can see the logic of it, is let's just take the question of joining NATO off the table. In actual fact, the NATO rules say that any individual country in NATO can veto any other country joining it, and countries which have got an internal civil conflict are barred automatically. Now, this whole thing about the invasion of Ukraine fails to recognise that there's actually a civil war in the Ukraine, just like there was a civil war inside Serbia with the Kosovo Liberation Army fighting the Serbian military to create an independent state in Kosovo. And we intervened on the side of the Kosovans. There was a 73-day bombing campaign by NATO. We bombed the Belgrade television station and killed Serbian weather girls as a way of punishing them for lying. And thousands of civilians were killed during that 73-day bombing campaign. But we did it so that Kosovo could be free. Now, the Russians are saying, we opposed that at the time because it sets a precedent, doesn't it? And we said, it doesn't matter. It's really, really important. Kosovo must be free. So therefore, there's a 73-day bombing campaign. The Russians have had a two-day military operation, and they're the pariah state. And it's just ridiculous. And in Russia itself, the hypocrisy of all of this is becoming increasingly apparent. The comparisons between Yugoslavia in the 1990s, what happened in Ukraine now, are obvious to anybody who really looks into it. In Yugoslavia, the Western powers encouraged breakaway republics. The Slovenians, who began the fighting, their National Guard opened fire on the Yugoslav National Army, which was just trying to... They voted for independence, a bit like Donetsk and Luhansk, and the Yugoslav National Army was proceeding through Slovenia to control the border. So that's all they wanted to do. They weren't going to try and take on the Slovenians. But the Slovenian National Guard, without warning, opened fire on the Yugoslav National Army and began the war in Yugoslavia with all of the consequences. A bit like the Irish rebels in 1916 seizing the GPO in Dublin. Now, the problem for the West is all of this. You can see they're all going here, here, bloviating away. And you feel like saying, what about all of these other? I mean, Yugoslavia is the obvious comparison. It's the obvious comparison. And the Russians at the time said, you're setting precedents here, which later on you're going to regret. And they were told, shut up. We don't take any notice of what you say. And the Russians say, well, now is the time. This is payback time. We told you at the time not to go to war about Kosovo and you said it was OK. Right. We're going to war for the East Ukraine. Exactly the same justification that you gave for bombing Serbia back to the Stone Age.
OK, so can we have a listen now to another excerpt from yesterday in the House of Commons, where we hear from Labour MP Chris Bryant. I'm just hoping to hear a little bit of something about maybe we should have been listening back in December when the olive branch was sitting there saying, you know, let's have a security treaty. Let's try and avert war in Eastern Europe. Well, it seems that Britain and America are way too far away, thousands of miles away, and they don't really care what happens in Eastern Europe. But let's see what Chris Bryant has to say about as a reaction to Boris and Starmer's speeches there. He is basically saying he's wondering who's going to be next, Ukraine and who next.
Chris Bryant.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister is absolutely right. We equivocated shamelessly after Crimea. We were spineless. We must not be spineless now, because what will inevitably happen is either the Baltic states, one of the members of NATO, or perhaps Sweden or Finland will feel the wrath of Putin next. And that will mean British action. Don't we need to try and set in train now a process whereby Putin himself ends up in the dock in a court? Norman Burkitt said, who was the alternate British judge at Nuremberg, said at Nuremberg, initiating a war of aggression is not only an international crime, it is the supreme international crime, differing only from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole. He must be brought to a court of law and end his days in prison, mustn't he?
Mr. Speaker, I think one of the most fascinating things about what Putin is doing is how close an analogy there is between his actions and those of Slobodan Milosevic. Exactly the same nonsense being peddled about the mystical union between Kosovo and Belgrade as between Kiev and Moscow. Exactly the same aggression. And remember that Slobodan Milosevic died on trial. Sorry.
So that was Labour MP Chris Bryant there, Martin. Now he's pointing out, he's saying, actually, you know, this is part of a pattern. We've seen Crimea, now Ukraine. Where next? And he's got a point, hasn't he? Because actually the Baltic states are only very little further away from Moscow than the north of Ukraine is.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Russian army, if it's going to exist, is always going to be in a position to invade the neighbouring countries, unless it's completely disbanded. And that's not going to be the case while they feel threatened by NATO, is it? So we're a long way from that. Now, isn't it interesting that there they are comparing... Kosovo was an autonomous region within Serbia. It didn't have any independence within Serbia before 1972, because during the war in the Yugoslavia in the 1940s, the local Muslim population sided with the Germans. And there was, in fact, a Kosovar SS division that fought on the German side in the Yugoslav war in World War II. But as time went on and tempers cooled and things moved on, Tito, who was the guy in charge in Yugoslavia, decided that he was going to give the the Kosovars an autonomous region. It wouldn't be an independent republic because there was a difference between the two. So they'd have an autonomous region so they could manage their own affairs, independent of Belgrade, but they wouldn't be independent completely. So that was the creation of Kosovo. Then, of course, during the wars in Yugoslavia, the Western powers weaponized that by supporting the Kosovo Liberation Army, who were trying to free Kosovo by force. Ibrahim Rugova, who was a more pacifistic leader, was sidelined by the KLA because the KLA were being backed partly by drug running and also by Western powers because they wanted to break up Yugoslavia. Now, Ukraine is a far more artificial state in some ways than Yugoslavia was. It was actually, as Putin pointed out in his very long speech, which is very detailed on the history of Ukraine, is that the creation of the Ukraine was originally by the Bolshevik government in the 1920s. It had never existed as an independent state before that. So when we talk about a state that existed, it's only existed as an independent state since 1991. Yugoslavia existed since 1918. It was created at the end of the First World War. Now, all of this stuff about, you know, the supreme crown of invading countries and all the rest of it, starting wars. Well, that applies in spades to Tony Blair taking us to war in Iraq, which has led to an absolute disaster in that country and the neighboring countries. And it was without a UN resolution. Now, what makes things legal or illegal is a UN Security Council resolution. Now, when we went to war for Kosovo, we didn't have a UN Security Council resolution. When we went to war in Iraq, we didn't have a UN Security Council resolution because the French and the Germans were opposed to it. Now, what the lawyers in Russia are saying is we've got the Minsk Agreement that says, and that is a UN Security Council resolution, which says that the Kiev government has got to negotiate with the independent republics. They've refused to do it. Now we're imposing the Minsk Agreement on Kiev. Now, that in actual fact is legal, arguably. But our interventions in Kosovo, our interventions in Iraq, our intervention in Libya, our attempt to overthrow Assad, all of these things are illegal in international law. Now, what's going to really happen here is we're going to probably have a major war and some people are going to end up in the dock at the end of it. But it may not be Putin. It may be some people on our side. What about the people who organized the Maidan sniper massacre? They were definitely probably Western intelligence agents, some of them British. Where is Brigadier Gordon Kerr these days, who ran the loyalist paramilitary campaign? Did he have any finger in this? Should he go to prison? Now, the thing about saying you're going to send people to prison like they've just done is that at that point, they've got no incentive to negotiate with you at all, have they? None whatsoever.
OK, Martin, we're going to leave Ukraine now. Interesting place to leave it. And we'll be back in half an hour with a former US diplomat to discuss Ukraine.
UK diplomat.
But, what did I say?
Said US diplomat.
A former UK diplomat, sorry, yep. And in the meantime, let's go back to look at some of the other stories this week. Most importantly and amazingly, the dropping of COVID restrictions. I saw a terrific cartoon sent to me by a journalist friend, which shows the COVID virus going out of one door and a nuclear bomb coming in the other door for Thursday's calendar day. But anyway, so the dropping of the COVID restrictions in the UK, Kerry McCarthy, our Bristol East MP, did mention this and she was talking about it yesterday. So let's go back to her where she talks about the ending in the UK. Actually, I think it's only in England, isn't it, for the time being, because everything in Wales and Scotland takes a little bit longer, and Northern Ireland. Yesterday, on the same day as this invasion, the end of the COVID restrictions, it's the Bristol East MP, Kerry McCarthy.
You have clinically extremely vulnerable constituents, I think it's about 500,000 people, who are very worried about what this means for them, because whereas other people might feel now fairly secure going about their daily business, for those people, they're in some cases like still extremely anxious about it. And there is the worry that if people have to pay for tests, even though it's a small cost, they won't be testing. And then the fact that they won't have to isolate. You know, we've seen that some people have quite a reckless attitude to public health during this crisis. Other people are absolutely doing their best to keep other people safe. So I worry that the pandemic is not over. People are still dying of COVID. People are still contracting. Potentially newer strains coming along. And although people do want to return to normal, I think that, you know, public health protection has still got to be there. And I don't think it's a massive, in terms of the government providing the free tests and people wearing masks where they can, I don't think that's too much to ask, really.
£2 billion, though, just on the testing. Yeah. Testing, obviously, will stay free until the 1st of April, people won't be able to get hold of them for free. It's still a lot of money, though, isn't it?
It is a lot of money, but then if you think about hours lost because of people being off sick with COVID, and, you know, the economic hit and so on, the economic hit that you would take if you didn't keep it under control. And let's say that, you know, Omicron took us slightly by surprise, there could be another strain that comes along and we're back in that situation. I think it's a price worth paying. I think you probably get fewer people testing as they feel that it's not as much of a threat. So the costs wouldn't be perhaps as, you know, people wouldn't be testing twice a week like some people have been doing. But I think it's important that people, if they suspect they've got COVID, aren't deterred from taking a test so that they can make the right decision about keeping people safe.
Well, how about that? No more testing, Martin.
Well, no more free testing.
Well, I mean, for a lot of people, that's simply going to mean that they don't get a test, isn't it?
Yep, that's right. Well, I mean, you know, we have these debates every week. And obviously the balance of what to do is perceived differently in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland than it is in England. I think
or New Zealand, for example, where they're going trying to get everyone to have mandatory vaccines.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is on. I mean, we spent the whole first hour and a half talking about warfare. And of course, you know my position on COVID. I think it's a biological warfare agent created by the West and infiltrated into China.
Yeah.
So in a sense, what we're talking about is the same stuff.
Enhanced by a psychological warfare campaign to strip everyone of their rights.
No, if there's a virus, listen, I think all of these things we're talking about are related to warfare, all of them. Yeah, I don't see it as a different topic at all.
Anyway, can you not find a little tiny part of you that feels a bit of joy at not having to go through these restrictions?
I think everybody wants this to be over. Everybody wanted World War II to be over. But it ain't over till it's over.
Well, it is over because Omicron has been proved to be basically just like many people said the original COVID was, which I would definitely, you know, is questionable, saying that it's basically like getting a common cold. So the idea that you can get this, which, you know, will even Bill Gates apparently has come out recently and said that he's rather pleased with the way that Omicron seems like a natural vaccine. So, you know, even though he's not going to be making much money at that, paranoia before Christmas, which has actually been maintained in many countries in the European Union, we have now got over that completely.
Well, as I said, different countries have made different assessments of what they're going to do in relation to what's going on with COVID. And that's, you know, I mean, unless they're going to have a world government to give a world policy, that's the way it's going to be. I would like it to go away. I'd love, of course. I don't want it to be there at all, same as everybody else. But you've got to decide whether it's the right policy or not. I think what the TUC have been saying about the getting rid of free testing is that you're going to lead to a situation where people who ought to be tested and self-isolating aren't, and then you could get another wave which will affect the economy. This is what's happened three times in Britain.
Yeah, I mean,
they've made the wrong calls. They've had to have more lockdowns than they wanted than was necessary because they've made the wrong call at every turn.
Yeah, I mean,
it may not.
The whole idea of a national health service is that it should be free. So the idea of charging, all that's going going to mean is that the increasingly impoverished, poor British public are just simply not going to be doing the testing that they need to do.
And that's it's going to be the people on low wages in the gig economy who will say, well, I'm not going to be tested and I can't afford not to go to work. Of course, people who are going for their foreign skiing holidays in Switzerland with their banker's bonuses, they will be able to afford to buy a test.
This is a form of economic warfare, a bit like the sanctions on Russia. You know, this is sanctions on the poor in Britain, saying, well, you know, tough, you're going to catch COVID and you're not even going to know what it is and you can spread it around. We don't really care at all. So, you know, it's the same sort of bullying tactic, using money to just, you know, taking people's ability to actually do what's needed away from them just because you can. A bullying tactic. Anyway, look, we've also got Kerry, a final clip with her, talking, I thought was an interesting subject, about farming and about farm prices for the actual farmers themselves. But more importantly, the difficulty that farmers are getting hold of labour. I mean, the obvious thing to do, of course, is not to criminalise the travellers and the gypsies. They traditionally in this country, they have been the itinerant workers. They were largely replaced, of course, by foreign labour coming in from mostly from Eastern Europe. But, you know, the idea that you're not even going to talk about the fact that you used to have a massive force of itinerant labourers and now you're criminalising them at the same time as you're crying because you can't get the foreign labourers in. Anyway, let's have a listen to the final clip with Bristol East MP Kerry McCarthy talking about itinerant labour and farming prices.
Two big things, though, that the government needs to resolve. One is about the trade deals and undercutting our farmers by allowing cheaper, lower standard imports, which we've politically discussed a lot. And the other is the labour issue that was mentioned there. You know, the fact that we've cut off that supply of Eastern European labour. Huge impact.
The government says it's extending the season of culture. We are running out of time.
Bit of a quick clip, that. Don't let it catch you out. Look, it did me. Look, Martin, isn't it obvious that we've got to just not prosecute travellers for being travellers, because we desperately need them to work as itinerant labourers, particularly in the harvest seasons?
Look, the times when the travelling community used to go down and do the hops in Kent, or the EastEnders used to go to the hops, that's long gone. I'm in Herefordshire now as I'm speaking to you, and there's a whole industry grown up since the fall of the Berlin Wall and the extension of the European Union into Eastern Europe, which didn't exist before, which is producing soft fruit for sale in Britain using foreign labour. That industry didn't used to exist before 1989. So it's not a question of going back to the 1950s where a lot of labour in the East, you know, they don't even harvest hop. I used to harvest as a student. They don't even harvest like that anymore with hops.
Who used to pick the apples then?
The apples are picked by machines, Tony. And of course, ultimately, some things can't be picked by machines, soft fruit particularly, because machines mash it up. So you need people to do it. And a whole industry has developed here in Herefordshire where East Europeans come over here to work on the soft fruit industry. And it's been very good for Leinster, where I'm sitting, because all the pubs and Leinster used to be a fairly downhill place. But because of all these East Europeans coming here every summer, the pubs have done a roaring trade. The local shops have done a roaring trade, etc. This is what the European Union was all about. But of course, if you leave the European Union, you can't have that cheap labour. And therefore, what will happen is not that the people in... Do you remember a couple of years ago, Prince Charles was going on about, because of the COVID restrictions and so on, we'll have to go to the fields and pick this stuff ourselves. Now, in actual fact, they try to get British people to do it. But of course, they have to move to live in a different part of the country just for a few weeks or months. And they've got to come off any benefits they're on to do it. And it's just not attractive for British people to do that work. Now, there's nothing wrong with it. The people who come here to do it here in Leinster are people who want to build a house, perhaps, back in Bulgaria. And the money they earn here is pitiful to British standards. When they take it back to Bulgaria, they can buy the wherewithal to build a house. So for them, it's good money. For us, it isn't. Now, in other words, what happens when you change the rules, like you do by leaving the European Union, with leaving the single market and all the rest of it, is certain businesses become unviable. And the soft fruit industry round here is one of them. And it'll just collapse. That's what happened in it. It won't get British people instead of, and the travellers are going to do this work. It's just not going to exist because they won't be able to make it exist.
Well, final but one story. The police are attempting to force a journalist into revealing his sources over the Birmingham 6 pub bombings. Police attempting to force journalist Chris Mullin, says the Morning Star, to reveal sources from his notes containing a murder confession over the Birmingham pub bombings. Now, Martin, this is a notorious IRA attack. But most importantly, to do with this attack in Birmingham, there was a horrific cover up, and a whole load of people who quite clearly hadn't done it were arrested. So let's have a listen now to. I'll let you comment afterwards. We've heard from a friend of mine in contact, Chris Hewitt, who I spoke to earlier this week about this whole business of Chris Mullins, who's a former MP. He also wrote a terrific book and a film, which was, what was it called? It's gone out of my mind. You remember it, Martin? A Very British Coup. And if you haven't seen that film, watch it. It's all about the Wilson plot, actually, back in the 1970s, where the Prime Minister was bounced out of office by the security services. Anyway, Chris Mullin is a bit of a hero as a journalist and an MP. And it's just disgusting to see the police now pursuing him, even though it was them that carried out this horrific miscarriage of justice back in the 1980s. So let's have a listen now then to Chris Hewitt talking about Chris Mullins and the Birmingham Six sources.
He literally got complaints from all the people who tried to get their own MPs doing it, and they wouldn't, because one thing about Chris, he was a bit like Dave Nellist in Coventry or Tony Benn or people like that. They would take up very unpopular cases that nobody else would touch.
So he's an ex-MP, isn't he, Chris Mullins? Ex-Labour MP.
Yeah, he's ex-Labour MP, and he was also he was by profession a journalist. He's certainly getting letters from people who knew the Birmingham Six were innocent and he couldn't get their own MPs to raise them. Now, I did tell Chris that 3 days after the Birmingham pub bombings, I was walking past Coventry Police Headquarters and I was called over by, this was about 2:10, and I was called over by a group of about half a dozen coppers who knew I was a working journalist. And they told me the serious crime squad had arrested the wrong people. And now, obviously I couldn't know, well, I think they're all dead anyway, but they had to stay off the record because they would have, if they'd gone public, they'd have probably lost their jobs. Now, when I interviewed Sir Philip Knights, the late Chief Constable of West Midlands, in the 9th of May 1984, I asked him about this because he said to Philip, I'm increasingly finding it difficult to find any of your officers who believe the Birmingham Six are guilty, you know. And he said, oh, no, he said, I read the file before you arrived, the evidence is overwhelming. He's particularly surprising because Knights was normally pretty straight with the media.
So what's the significance of the journalist MP, Chris Mullin, being told he's got to reveal his sources?
Well, I can't understand it because nearly everyone involved are dead. You know, like I said, when Chris made that programme, I think if he'd walked up to, two or three dozen West Midlands coppers in the street, they would have told you they believe the Birmingham Six are innocent. You know,
it's even before it was exposed.
Yeah. I think it was about 85 because, and because there was a TV program, a very good TV program made on it. And,
World in Action, I think.
That's right, something like that, yes. And, it was very well done. And there was also a TV play on it, where they had Martin Shaw, of the Professionals, playing the one of the investigative journalists. And but he said, I just do not understand it. I mean, I can think of far more important collars that want measuring.
Interestingly, you mentioned the Freemasons in connection with Hillsborough, but what about and possibly with other things? But that definitely was a very big interest of Chris Mullins, wasn't it?
Yes. Although I must say that the vast majority of Freemasons are honest, law-abiding citizens. Until an expose came out on it, Stephen Knight's expose of it, it was almost impossible to get expelled. But since then, the Masons have disciplined more people than they've done in the previous 500 years put together.
Horrifyingly, still people have not been actually convicted for the pub bombings, Martin. 21 deaths on the 21st of November 1974.
Well, the reason for that is because West Midlands Crime Squad just beat up the first paddies they could find and said they did it. There was never an investigation. And there was only an investigation carried out once the Birmingham Six had been released. There was the possibility to carry out a further investigation. And as the journalist we just heard from said...
Yeah, that's Chris Hewitt, sorry. Yeah, Chris Hewitt.
Chris Hewitt just said, the fact is that the people that actually did the bombings are now dead. What Chris... Most of them, we don't know for sure. Anyway, what Chris Mullins did back in the day is he contacted the IRA and they said to him, we will confess to doing the bombings so that the Birmingham Six can be released, but you mustn't say what our identity is. We want the Birmingham Six to be released. You know, we know they didn't do it, and it's not fair that they should be punished for it. And if it will help, we will confess to doing it as long as we can remain anonymous.
You know what? There's a horrifying side to this, and it's almost as if the police in Birmingham were practicing at the most outrageous. What could be the most outrageous miscarriage of justice we could do? Just arrest a load of random Catholics or Irish people and fit them up for something and get away with it.
Well, I think that the West Midland Crime Squad was ultimately disbanded completely because of all sorts of bad behaviour. And it's now even changed the name, like Windscales changed to Sellafield. It's now called West Mercia Police. But that's because they had to change the name. And the Birmingham Six was like a cherry on the cake. They were known, basically, for cutting corners. Yeah, they'd just grab anybody and fit them up. And that was the problem. And what they did there, as you can imagine, there's general outrage about what's happened. Everybody's screaming blue murder. Something's got to be done. West Midlands Crime Squad, crash, bang, wallet. We've got the guys. They beat the hell out of them, basically, and made them confess.
But you know what? I mean, the big changes that took place in the 70s and 80s within the police, they had these, you know, serious crime squads. The idea was that there's corruption within some of the local forces. So you have big regional detective forces who can investigate the crimes that the police are covering up. We now got something called the National Crime Agency, haven't we, which is like basically like an FBI in London that's supposed to do almost all the investigating of serious crime for the whole country. So the local forces are now just not trusted to do anything. And even if they do find somebody that's actually a serious organised criminal who has maybe some connections with the establishment, you'll find that the Crown Prosecution Service are another hurdle they've got to get over in order to get any kind of prosecution at all. So we have a broken criminal justice system.
Yeah, but leaving that aside, Tony, the issue that's at stake here is, in future, if journalists go to people and say, I'm going to protect your anonymity as long as, you know, you tell me what's going on. Well, the government are actually selling nuclear arms to North Korea on the sly, but I can't tell you who I am. They won't talk to journalists.
Yeah, well, that's right.
That's why the National Union of Journalists are supporting Chris Mullin in court, because they're saying the principle that journalists should not have to name anonymous sources is an important journalistic principle.
We've got to press on. So we've got another clip from Chris Hewitt now, which is about Robert Maxwell, who he had some connections with himself. Maxwell, of course, worked for the Mossad, is the father of Ghislaine Maxwell, of Jeffrey Epstein fame and infamy. And also, he believes that Maxwell himself, the newspaper owner of the Mirror, who disappeared in very bizarre circumstances, apparently a kind of suicide, was actually a triple agent.
Maxwell was a triple agent. He was working for MI5 KGB, but his true boss of bosses was Mossad, which is the Israeli equivalent of MI6. That's why he's buried in the special place reserved for Israel's most important supporters and citizens.
Well, yes, but I mean, that isn't necessarily mean he's working for the Mossad. What other evidence have you got that he was?
Well, some of his supporters only after his death. I think Mossad did grudgingly admit that Maxwell was one of theirs. But you see, one of the reasons he was popular with the security spooks is because he knew so many of the top brass in Eastern Europe on first name terms.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very clever psychologist. What he did is he went around to see the leaders of all the Eastern European countries and offered to publish their memoirs in the UK. So he sort of go in and he'd give them six or seven simple questions, and then he'd tape record it, and then that, he'd just stick that into a book, and you know, print off 1,000 copies, which they then gave out to all their mates, and they thought he was very wonderful, because they also started saying things that perhaps they shouldn't have done if their security chiefs had been in the room. But basically, he was certainly very, very influential, and we don't know the level of support or deals that he did behind the Iron Curtain, but certainly believed that he helped get people released.
Well, he died in very peculiar circumstances, didn't he?
No, he committed suicide. It's typical of Maxwell to make it look as if there's a question mark. Like I said, he's a very clever man. You see, if the coroner ruled he'd committed suicide, then his wife wouldn't have got the whopping great life insurance. So he got a very tough anti-suicide clause in it. Right? But he topped himself. You see, he had to pay either 60 million in cash or banker's draft to Credit Suisse by midday the next day, which he couldn't do. That would have meant that Credit Suisse would immediately suspend his account and use the interbank network to inform all the other countries in the world that to shut Maxwell's accounts. So he'd have had a bankruptcy hearing in most of the countries in the world. And Maxwell could only get away with telling his whoppers for so long.
Don't you think it's possible that an agency as professional as the Mossad might have disappeared him?
Maxwell wouldn't need Mossad's help to do that. He was certainly clever enough to do that without anyone's help.
Well, to change his identity and basically pop up.
Well, like I said, he was probably our top agent in SOE. He wouldn't have any problem getting false passports, plastic surgery, etc. But in fact, most people at the Mirror at the time didn't believe he'd topped himself. We actually had to show them the autopsy pictures.
Oh, right, really? So even his own staff didn't believe him?
No. I mean, there were still plenty of people in the Mirror who believe he's alive somewhere somewhere where there's no... It has to be someone who has an extradition treaty.
What about his interesting... His daughter has come to prominence, hasn't she, recently?
Ghislaine? She's Daddy's favourite girl. His yacht was named after her. There's a friend of mine who was a freelance accountant, and he once was commissioned to go and audit Maxwell's accounts at Headington Hall in Oxford. And he said, it's the only time in his life he'd ever walked out on a job. He said, you think Maxwell was bad, his daughter was even worse.
What, you mean juggling money around and so
on? Well, yeah, being generally nasty and frightening people.
Oh, right. Threats, this sort of thing.
Yeah. In fact, the only pity is it isn't her father in jail as well.
So that's Chris Hewitt. Thanks very much for that interview, Chris. And I'll put the full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Loads of nuggets from Chris Hewitt, from the former Coventry Telegraph journalist there. Martin, all this stuff about Maxwell, it's pretty clear, isn't it? The Maxwell-Mossad connection.
Absolutely. And that's what probably explains what's happened with Epstein and Ghislaine. The whole thing is a sting. Well, it's a honey trap operation by Mossad to control US politics.
Anyway, something a little bit lighter to finish with before we have our break, and that is an occasional guest on our programme, and sometimes as a live guest as well, has been Matthew Williams, based in Devizes. Matt has started his notorious rise to notoriety as a circle maker, that is to say crop circles, and he talks to that, me about that in the full version of this interview, which will be up on our show page at this week. .org.uk later tonight. I phoned Matt because I'd seen on his video channel, actually it was a sound engineer, Dave, who pointed it out to me on his internet channel, but on YouTube, that he'd actually gone down to Birnbeck Pier, which is a pier in Western Supermare, which has been derelict for years. It looks like it's all falling apart, but he decided to go over the fence and get right out to Birnbeck Island along this fragile pier thing, which looks like it's falling apart. It looks like a kind of Scooby-Doo island, and this is what Matthew Williams found there.
It looked amazing, and I mean, you could see the remnants of stairs leading to an upstairs, which would have been a house. You could see rooms that would have had, there was a toilet there. You know, the floors are disintegrating, and I mean, you know, anyone who tries to walk around up there is going to fall through the floor. They probably get a spike through their leg, and you know, it's not going to be good. So don't try what you see in our videos, but yeah, we did see some bits that you don't normally get to see by climbing around, and it looked fascinating, and I just couldn't believe that somebody let it go. You know, they let it just disintegrate by letting the roof. What tends to happen, this is what I believe happens, they let the roof go, and once you let the roof go and the water starts getting in, that's it, everything will just disintegrate underneath. And that's what seems to have happened. And now the roof has collapsed. The metal girders are kind of precarious there. There's bits of metal swinging around inside. It's something else to look at. And it is dangerous, but it's eerie and spooky and ghostly. You know, they've got the old piano there, an organ there. And you can imagine somebody would have been sitting there playing the piano to people having their food.
Amazing. Well, what about, are there bits of the old amusement arcade, bits of the restaurant, bits and pieces, ephemera still hanging around out there?
Oh, I'm sure it all is, but you can pick it up in your hand and it's sort of like it's dust now. it just falls between your fingers, you know. So, yeah, it's all still there, you know, in dust form. Yeah.
Well, what are your thoughts about why such a fantastic resource as this? Obviously, this is a prime bit of real estate has been allowed to fall into such disrepair.
Well, I've got a personal belief on this, and I don't know whether some people agree with me, that there's listed buildings and listed status. It's very hard for people to work within the confines of the listed building procedure. You know, working with, you have to use the same materials, it has to have the same look, and it's very expensive. So what people tend to do is they buy up these places saying, oh, I'm going to do this up, so they get it on a deal, because they know it's going to cost millions more than it would normally cost, you know, tens of millions more to do the same work. They buy these things up promising, you know, I'll do the work. So they get a deal. They get a really cheap deal on this land. So now they've got the land and they do nothing. And it's by design. They do nothing. It was planned that way because they want the buildings to fall apart. Because once the buildings are actually no more than dust or rubble, then they can come along and ask for planning permission to do whatever they want.
Yeah, so maybe they'll do something similar as what's happened at Knightstone Island, just a bit further down the coast there in Western, where it's been all redeveloped into luxury flats.
Yes. And I mean, it's sad in a way that, you know, things are kind of restrictive, but I think there are also these chancers who play the system, you know, to get cheap deals, promising that they will keep these places with the roofs on. And they're actually destroying heritage. They're destroying very interesting locations by being greedy. You know, they should never be allowed to have these places. And I personally think there should be a change to the listing laws or property laws, that if you don't start work within, say, 6 months, there's no signs of anything starting. Within a year, you'll have it taken off you.
So that's Matthew Williams there, his little adventure down Birnbeck Pier. And you can find him on his YouTube channel. But the reason I actually spoke to him really was to do with Port and Down, because not only does he go out to Birnbeck Pier, good old harmless Birnbeck Pier, which is actually pretty dangerous. Don't try it at home. And in fact, Matt explains that in his the longer piece, how you really do need to have to know what you're doing before you try any of these things. So just simply don't do it. Otherwise, you end up dead in the sea. Is at Porton Down. So this is where the British chemical biological weapons facilities are, near Salisbury. And he decided he was going to go and test their security.
What I actually did was just drove my car as far as I could before somebody stopped me. So I didn't do anything that was technically illegal, because I drove through gates, I drove as close as I could to the base, and I got very close to areas that I thought I would never be able to get that close to. And I thought to myself after I did it, I thought, how are they letting people get this close? Because surely if somebody who had bad intentions was doing what I'm doing now, they'd be able to get way too close.
Amazing. And, well, hang on, because, you know, so what you're saying is the way to get into Porton Down is not to climb over a fence or tunnel under it or something. It's just to drive in the main gate.
Yes, and I've got to say that although they've got some guys with guns, I think that people would still be able to just do something really silly there, because you're way too close. By the time you see those military guards and you see those checkpoints, if you just put your foot down, you'd be right next to buildings that containing some of the most deadly viruses on the planet, and that could be game over. And my whole purpose for publishing that and showing people that there's some very strange planning has gone on for the areas that keep you out around it. It's like all the security. If you imagine, if you draw a line down the center with an arc, a crescent on the right hand side, everything to the left of this line of the cake, so the left hand side of the cake, there's no protection. So that left hand side of the base, you can walk right up to it and you can throw a tennis ball at the buildings. There's nothing. There's no laws to say stay out. But if you cross across onto the right hand side of the cake, there's military guards, there's laws, and there's things saying you can't go in there. But I was just pointing out, you know, hang on, guys. What about the left-hand side of the base? Because I can literally walk up and throw a tennis ball at the side of the base. And it's a dog walking. It's right next to a railway. But, you know, you're literally looking at the side of the base. So, I mean, it doesn't take much imagination to think of what creative things some dastardly people could do. And for the sake of what's just happened with a certain pandemic that we've just had, we don't want anything getting out of labs. So we don't want crazy people getting near labs. So my intention was to just kind of pique the security's interest so they think about it and maybe actually move their borders out a little bit.
Yeah, so I'll put a link up to Matt Williams' Circle Makers TV, Truth Seekers 666, he calls himself, or The Secret Vault. There's various channels that Matthew's got. And I'll put a complete version of that up on our show page, thisweek.org.uk. That's Martin puffing, I think, there, puffing and panting. But anyway, we shall be back talking to a British diplomat, former British diplomat, about Ukraine after the break.
Please. Ёйчеже, очень здорова моя девочка чёрно-бронзовая.
Top Thumping from Chumbawamba. And before that we heard, it was a traditional Ukrainian song. Before that was the Cambridge Singers, The King of Love, My Shepherd Is. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. For those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and the former British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford. Hi, Peter. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, could you just give us your first take on how surprised were you yesterday?
Moderately surprised, though. To be honest, I thought from the beginning of the crisis that Russia was serious, and that it was prepared to actually take over control in the whole of Ukraine, but that they really thought that the Western powers would realize that they needed to negotiate seriously on Russia's requests. This didn't happen, and therefore they reverted to Plan B. and the opportunities for compromising, negotiating with Russia have been lost. And now we're faced with a fait accompli, which will be, I think, totally over within a matter of days.
Yeah, but we're told again and again that Putin is not the kind of guy that you can negotiate with.
Well, that's nonsense. many others have negotiated with Russia. He has Putin has the most capable foreign minister on the planet in Sergei Lavrov. But on the other side, he's dealing with children. In international diplomacy, it's Russia that brings or tries to bring some adult supervision. No, that's nonsense. Russia put forward some quite reasonable and sensible proposals, a proper return to implementation of the existing Minsk agreements, some long-term security arrangement for Europe, and possibly, I think, neutrality status for Ukraine. I really don't know why Ukraine can't be like Austria. Austria has enjoyed a status of neutrality since 1955 by Austria's own decision, and has enjoyed peace and prosperity ever since. What's wrong with that? Honestly, this would be the best solution for Ukraine, and in the long term, I think that's where it's all heading, a status of neutrality.
Now, Peter, it's actually not so long ago when you were acting ambassador in Syria, 15 years or so, maybe 17, 18 years or so. What do you think, I mean, have things really changed since you were part of the diplomatic staff? Because surely the job of the Foreign Office is to talk to and negotiate. And I'm really quite staggered that something so important as this draft treaty, which was put forward back in December by the Russians, saying, look, you know, things are starting to fall apart in Eastern Europe and we need to have some mutual guarantees. You would have thought the Foreign Office would snap at that and say, great idea.
Well, I'm afraid since 9/11, we, Britain, America, have become addicted to military aggression. And initially, it often seems to work, like when we went into Afghanistan, and it seemed easy. And Iraq, at the beginning, it seemed easy, didn't it? And then we got rid of Gaddafi, and that was easy. But we stubbed our toe on Assad in Syria. But still, the first impulse, whenever anybody stands up to us, is military aggression. And I'm afraid that's what we're seeing now.
But I mean, for example, in Eastern Europe, you've surely got to have some sort of guarantee of security. You know, you can't just say, right, well, we're just going to fight and we're not going to talk to anybody. Well, obviously, we're going to talk to our allies and friends. But this is of massive importance to the whole of Europe, really, not least of which is looking at the kind of energy prices and the gas prices. And, you know, we need to have a good relationship with our Eastern neighbors. In Europe,
it always used to be said that trade between two blocs or two countries was crucial for the preservation of peace and stability. But since we've become addicted to sanctions because they seem easy, and because we, as the more powerful partner in any relationship, can bully others and have so far gotten away with it. Now we're finding that sanctions against Russia are backfiring on us. We're shooting ourselves in the foot. I mean, I hear our politicians boasting that Russia is taking heavy hits. Well, my pension fund has just dropped by 5% thanks to the British government, and we're all facing triply expensive gas bills before long. The sanctions are backfiring, and it's absolutely ludicrous. There is no possibility that they will actually work in terms of preventing Russia from going ahead with what it's now embarked on. I don't think we even claim that they will work. So the only point is for politicians to practice virtue signaling at our taxpayer, ordinary citizen expense.
So what's going on, Peter? Because this doesn't make any sense, does it? If our government is actually there to look out for its own and our interests, it seems that there is something has supervened. It's got in the way. It's taken over. That is, they want to have a confrontation with the Russians.
Well, I think we have to look at the UK domestic politics a bit here. Boris obviously is loving this because it's a distraction, isn't it, from his Partygate problems. And he can pose as his favourite hero, Churchill. He's loving it, and for that reason, ramping it up. Britain has been one of the foremost in Russophobia and aggravating this crisis, pouring fuel on the flames by sending more weapons into Ukraine. And Starmer as well is using the crisis to paint a picture of Labour as being very patriotic. He's trying to live down the legacy of the peacemonger, Jeremy Corbyn, and pose as a warmonger, at least as good, in fact, better than Boris. It's Starmer who, I think, was the first to demand the silencing of the RT channel, which was providing some balance to the media coverage.
What exactly do you think is going on? Why is the idea of negotiation over security in Eastern Europe, why is it all out of the window? What's the real agenda behind the scenes? Have you any insight into that at all? Because it just doesn't seem to make sense. It's like I said just now, it's that a decision has been made that these people are going to be our enemies.
Well, I may be wrong. I don't have any inside information, but it seems to me inevitable that there will not be any serious negotiations involving the Western powers, but there will be some accommodation with senior members of the Ukrainian establishment, probably involving some generals, to get rid of President Zelensky, send him into exile, and install a caretaker government. I mean, after all, isn't this what we do when we wade into countries? When we waded into Afghanistan, we installed locals as a new provisional administration and then acquired a veneer of legitimacy through elections. We did the same in Iraq. We tried to do the same in Syria. I mean, it's embarrassing to remember now, but we actually went as far as recognizing an alternative government for Syria. And that didn't get very far. But then we weren't controlling the shots in Damascus. Putin will very shortly be controlling the shots in Kiev.
How do you think we've got to this particular crisis in Ukraine? Because a lot of people in Ukraine, Peter, are throwing up their hands and saying, well, hang on, we did everything for you and now you've disappeared and the Russians are running around in their tanks.
Tough. Life is hard, isn't it? But that's the point of the whole crisis, that the West is not committed absolutely to Ukraine's defense. Imagine the pickle we'd be in if NATO was treaty bound to go wading in to Ukraine, or if it had been allowed to establish even more forward bases than it had already. I suspect that historians will look back on this and say that the trajectory that we were on before the Russian intervention was a trajectory towards World War III, but Russia drew a line in the sand and stopped the worst happening.
Well, so hang on. I mean, most of the commentators are saying that it looks like Putin could have started World War III. You're saying he could have. He's stopped it happening. So how do you get to there?
Well, we really have to stop being hysterical. We're nowhere near the start of World War III. That would only happen if the West was stupid enough to attack Russia. Russia is not going to invade a NATO member like Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia. We're sending troops there, again, just virtue signaling so the politicians can say they're doing something, but it's just displacement activity. We had our chance to act decisively before the invasion kicked off, but we didn't take the Russians seriously. And now and the poor Ukrainians are paying the price. But it's very hard to prove a counterfactual what would have happened if something hadn't gone ahead. But I'm fairly confident that when we look back in like in 5 years' time, a fair-minded historian will say that it was all for the good.
Do you think you can put a fag paper between the British and American policy on this? Are we just doing what the Americans want?
This is all about America and Russia, isn't it? NATO is just the instrument that America uses to extend its own sphere of influence, as they call it, or area of control, in Europe. They want to have this sphere of influence while denying Russia its own sphere of influence in its own backyard. So this is more about American failures to take Russia seriously. I mean, when you think back to the high hopes when the days of Gorbachev, the breakup of the Soviet Union, the wonderful opportunity that was there and which has been squandered by reckless Western politicians led by the Americans, who simply saw it as an opportunity to take advantage of Russia's weakness and march NATO up to the frontiers of Russia. This will be seen by future historians as a colossal, colossal mistake.
Well, I guess they just want to grab territory, Peter. And, you know, if they feel that they're doing something by getting resources from the territory that they get. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Joe Biden. Yesterday, the US president, took him quite a while to come out and give a speech. And let me be quite frank about Joe Biden and his speeches, is if you were to string them all together, you could have a great radio station for insomniacs. But so that we won't have too long a clip from it. So let's have a listen now to an excerpt from Joe Biden's speech, where he talks about the purpose of the US sanctions and the global sanctions, or at least the Western sanctions, are to stunt the economy, the tech, techie technical rise, and also the military. So let's have a listen now to Joe Biden's and the aims of his sanctions, and then Peter, maybe we can hear from you about whether you think that those sanctions will achieve those aims.
I just spoke with the G7 leaders this morning, and we're in full and total agreement. We will limit Russia's ability to do business in dollars, euros, pounds, and yen to be part of the global economy. We'll limit their ability to do that. We're going to stunt the ability of to finance and grow the Russian military. We're going to impose major, and we're going to impair their ability to compete in high-tech 21st century economy. We've already seen the impact of our actions on Russia's currency and the ruble, which early today hit its weakest level ever, ever in history. The Russia stock market plunged today. The Russian government's borrowing rates spiked by over 15%. In today's actions, we've now sanctioned Russian banks that together hold around $1 trillion in assets. We've cut off Russia's largest bank, a bank that holds more than one-third of Russia's banking assets by itself, cut it off from the U.S. financial system. And today, we're also blocking four more major banks. That means every asset they have in America will be frozen. This includes VTB, the second largest bank in Russia, which has $250 billion in assets. As promised, we're also adding the names to the list of Russian elites and their family members that are sanctioning, that were sanctioned as well. As I said on Tuesday, these are people who personally gained from the Kremlin's policies, and they should share in the pain. We will keep up this drumbeat of those designations against corrupt billionaires in the days ahead.
So apparently the Russian economy is going to be stunted, as well as it will prevent their military from being able to develop or grow, and of course shut them out from the 21st century technological revolution, Peter.
Well, it's not going to happen, is it? Russia has been under US sanctions for a number of years. And has, thanks to those sanctions, developed many local industries. In fact, the sanctions have backfired by making Russia more self-reliant. And anyone who thinks that Putin has been so stupid as to launch this operation without having ensured that he could survive sanctions is not paying attention. In particular, they've not been paying attention to how Russia has drawn closer to China. China has Russia's back, and they will compensate for any Western sanctions, that's for sure. So this is just empty boasting. And what does Biden and Johnson think? That Putin's going to come out with his hands up and say, oh, you got me. Oh, sorry, guys. Yeah, I apologize. Yeah, I'm going to leave Ukraine. Please, please, let's be adults. This is not going to happen. This is just the West virtue signaling, showing how moral they are, punishing the aggressor. But it's not going to work. And in the meanwhile, it's going to hurt us. What do they think will happen when Russian banks can't pay their debts to the West? Huh? Who's that going to penalize? Us. That's why the Russians have not been kicked off SWIFT, because the Europeans know that it's European banks that would collapse if that were to happen, because they need to receive Russia's payments through that system. No, the sanctions are a blunt instrument. They've never worked in the past. Give me an example of any sanctions that have actually produced what the Americans condescendingly call behavior change. No, they don't work. They're brutal. They punish the ordinary people, and they're totally futile.
Martin Summers, I wonder what you make of the ability of the Biden sanctions to affect. I mean, he seems to be convinced anyway that this is going to really he uses the word blunt, the Russian ability to develop military technology, to grow their military, and to keep up with the 21st century technological revolution.
Well, very interested to hear what Peter's had to say there, much of which I agree with, obviously. I used to be the East European desk officer for the New Economics Foundation in the 1990s. So I do have some background in the economics of the Eastern Bloc as it was in transition. Obviously, these sanctions are largely symbolic. They've been under sanctions for quite a while now, since the shooting down of MH17, which incidentally, of course, there's a whole story there that hasn't been told. But they've, as has been pointed out, they've adapted to this. They've got a strategy for dealing with it. And as we heard Johnson earlier in the program saying, the oil price is going up. Well, when the oil price goes up, don't forget the Russians collect the money for the oil in dollars. So the ruble going down is actually quite good for their export industries. And they collect the money for their oil in dollars, which actually improves their budget position. And since the 1990s, they've actually got to the situation where they don't have any international debt, really, because they realised that it made them vulnerable and that they're in quite a strong position. But I sometimes appear on RT, and one of the things I said when I was interviewed not long ago was just to carry out a thought experiment. What if it was possible to crash the Russian banking system by using these kind of techniques? I don't think it is, for the reasons I've just outlined, and as Peter pointed out, it'd be the European banks that would take the hit. But let's say you did do that. In 1998, the Russians turned round and said to their creditors, I'm afraid we can't pay our debts. And when they said that, they weren't Bangladesh or some minor country. This is a major country with nuclear weapons. When they say they can't pay, there's no way you can make them pay. And at that point, long-term capital management, which was a hedge fund in the US set up by Black and Scholes, based around the Black-Scholes theorem, which is supposed to be the latest in financial wizardry and the future of derivative trading, went bust. And that one company going bust nearly bankrupted the entire international banking system. And the US government had to step in and bail out the entire international banking system. And it set off a whole crisis in the banking system in Southeast Asia. So attempts to sanction Russia and China, even if they were successful, would simply set off another 2008 on steroids. Now, fortunately, it's not going to work. But even if it did, it's like a suicide bomb. It wouldn't work. It's just going to destroy the world economy. To what end? God knows.
Let's have a listen now to, thanks both of you. Let's have a listen to Ursula von der Leyen, the European Union president, speaking yesterday. She had a similar sort of a speech, I suppose, to Biden. And I will put Biden's full speech up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk for those insomniacs out there who might want to listen to the whole thing. But let's have a listen to a clip from Ursula von der Leyen there, where she talks really about explaining the political side, I suppose, of this as a very aggressive act by Russia towards Ukraine, which I suppose we will be hearing about again and again now as an aggressive act by Russia, whereas actually you can also see it as a defensive act where they simply have said, well, we need to have these security guarantees. You won't talk to us. So we've literally been left with very little option. So let's have a listen to the European Union President Ursula von der Leyen now, a short clip from her.
We will weaken Russia's economic base and its capacity to modernize. And in addition, we will freeze Russian assets in the European Union and stop the access of Russian banks to European financial markets. Like with the first package of sanctions, we are closely aligned with our partners and allies, the United States, the United Kingdom, Canada, but also, for example, Japan and Australia. These sanctions are designed to take a heavy toll on the Kremlin's interests and their ability to finance war. And we know that millions of Russians do not want war. President Putin is trying to turn the clock back to the times of the Russian Empire. But in doing so, He is putting at risk the future of the Russian people. I call on Russia to immediately stop the violence and to withdraw its troops from Ukraine's territory. We will not let President Putin tear down the security architecture that has given Europe peace and stability over many decades. We will not allow President Putin to replace the rule of law by the rule of force and ruthlessness. He should not underestimate the resolve and strength of our democracies. And history has proven that societies and alliances built on trust and freedom are resilient and successful. And that's exactly what the autocrats fear. The European Union stands with Ukraine and its people. We will continue to support them. Ukraine will prevail.
Well, I bet there's a few Ukrainians thinking, well, how exactly are you going to support us, Peter?
Yes, this is dangerous and empty rhetoric. This is what got us into this situation, building up false hopes on the part of Ukraine that somehow the EU and the US would step in and save it if it continued down its destructive path of not implementing the Minsk Accords and trying to insert itself into NATO. It's exactly this kind of language. And I mean, how can she even believe it herself? Is she deranged? It is totally irresponsible to encourage the illusion that Ukraine is going to survive in it, or the Ukrainian government is going to survive in its present form. It's demented. So to speak in these terms just shows how she's not in touch with reality and how unserious the EU is.
Well, it is a bit worrying, isn't it? And of course, we know that the Western press, much of it, is not really asking these sorts of awkward questions and saying, well, excuse me, President, that doesn't actually make sense, or it doesn't add up. What you've just said is just simply not true. You won't get that, it doesn't seem, from the Western press anymore. The only ones that do seem to ask the difficult questions, I think their strap line is question more, is RT. And I wonder, how long do you think they can last? The 2 weeks ago or so, they switched off, maybe 2.5 weeks, they switched off RT in Germany, Peter. Well, how long until the same happens here?
Well, I think the only thing that's stopping it is the BBC and fears that Russia will retaliate to the closure of RT by closing down BBC activities in Russia. Which the Foreign Office believe are very powerful. We value our propaganda organs at least as much as the Russians do. So that's what's protecting RT, not the so-called independence of Ofcom, which is a joke. Ofcom has a veneer of independence, but they will follow guidance from the government. So RT's future does hang by a thread. I wouldn't like to predict which way it will go, but it's noteworthy that it was Labour's Starmer who really made the situation worse by more or less forcing the government's hand on this. The government, clearly aware of the BBC dimension, didn't want to go down this track. But now they've been forced to by Starmer playing politics with national security.
I just wonder what you make of the, because if you're trying to stop not only diplomatic ties, those have broken down. We've seen all the, for example, the expulsion of the, actually, I think he just went home, didn't he? The US and and Russian ambassadors, you know, basically cutting off diplomatic relations last year. And once those sort of lines of communication go down and the general public lines of communication are going down too, it seems to me, you know, a major conflict is almost inevitable. These things tend to work on a ratchet system, Peter.
Well, it's not too tragic if a head of mission disappears because there's always a deputy. Channels of communication, and there are several levels as well. There are also intelligence agency contacts, which often go on under the radar. This is not lacking. What's lacking is the seriousness and the willingness to conduct a meaningful dialogue, showing some give and take. This has not been in evidence on the American side.
No, it certainly doesn't seem to have been. I think it'd be nice now to... I spoke yesterday to a former hedge fund manager who lives now in Monaco. He's originally Croatian, Alex Kraner, about the invasion of Ukraine by the Russians yesterday. And I asked him, I hope you can comment on what Alex says, Peter, that he's talking really about these draft treaties the Russians published back in December 2021 as the cause of this, and the very obvious cause, in his view, that the complete failure for the British and American and European diplomats to even attempt to negotiate any kind of arrangement for security over there. So let's have a listen now to Alex Kraner, where he talks about the Russian draft treaties that they made in December 2021.
Russia sent two draft treaties, one to the United States and one to the NATO. And my understanding is that a number of their points, there was some flexibility to some of their demands, but there was no flexibility to their demand that Ukraine could never ever become a member of NATO. That was their red line, and that was also the demand that was denied by both the United States and NATO, because they suddenly invented this principle that NATO is open to foreign countries who if they want to accede and become members of NATO, then and if NATO member states agree, then any country can become a member of NATO, which is absurd, because that's not what the NATO treaty actually says. And another thing that people have to appreciate is that this is not like a Boy Scout club. NATO is a protection racket type organization, and they don't. It's not like you fill in an accession form and then they interview you and then they say like, okay, you can come in. It takes years and years of preparations. And when Croatia was a becoming member of the NATO, we had for many years, we had NATO instructors and troops inside of Croatia preparing. And one of the things that happened is that your military intelligence becomes a part of NATO. They take control of that part of your society and the secret services in the country. So there's years and years of preparations. And so the NATO has had something like 10,000 instructors in Russia, in Ukraine since 2013. They have been, they created these training centers all over Ukraine, where they trained not only the troops but also Ukraine's diplomats, public servants, and journalists. Okay, and so there's this big, strong lobbying push within this country to make sure that it becomes a member of NATO, or at the very least an ally. And in Ukraine's case, the whole purpose was to turn Ukraine into a bludgeon to use to destabilize Russia eventually.
I think that's quite a nice analysis in my view. What do you think, Peter? The use of Ukraine as a bludgeon, basically?
Yeah. Yes, I agree totally with that. The Americans have been hoping since at least the, when was it, 2014, the coup, when a pro-Russian president was deposed in a CIA-sponsored coup and someone more amenable to Washington was brought in. This has been the ambition to for the long term, prepare Ukraine as a launching pad for eventual regime change in Moscow. This has been the American unstated but very obvious ambition. If the Americans had been serious, they would have taken the Russian document and suggested a compromise like a moratorium of 20 years during which possible Ukraine membership of NATO would have been taken off the table. This would have been a reasonable compromise. It wasn't even considered. So they've not been serious at all about negotiating.
One of the quite worrying things Alex is talking about there, it sounds like joining NATO, which is obviously one of the main subjects when you're talking about Ukraine, involves a massive amount of stuff which is going on behind the scenes. The merging of intelligence services, the merging of media, of finance, of the military too, Peter. Are you aware of that?
Well, it's becoming more and more clear, isn't it? And the existence of de facto American bases in Ukraine, of which I wasn't aware before. But this is standard operating procedure for the Americans, that they use all instruments of power, hard power and soft power. Mention was made of journalists, training journalists, indoctrinating them, rather. That's what that means. And EU membership was another proposed instrument. It's no wonder that Russia felt alarmed.
Martin Summers, I've followed from many years the NATO country's major political lobby, which is quite secretive. And actually, I remember at the Bilderberg conference in 2016, hearing from one of the staff in the big hotel where they were that Ursula von der Leyen, who was at that point being lined up to be EU president, was proudly sat on the Saturday night at the top table with Henry Kissinger in there. But it does seem as if we've got lots of these similar sorts of countries who are in NATO have a very, very, it's almost as if NATO is one country, that many of them are working very, very, very closely together. And although their individual parliaments are allowed a little bit of wriggle room, that basically they are as one nation.
Well, it's interesting in relation to former Yugoslavia, because of course some breakaway republics like Croatia have ended up in NATO. Others haven't, and others are being torn in, being put toyed with whether they should or shouldn't be allowed in. Incidentally, interestingly enough, of course, because Croatia is a NATO member, they have said, because NATO is actually quite an unwieldy organization, at least in principle, because they're supposed to come to unanimous decisions. And they ruled out immediately, we're not sending Croatian troops to intervene in the Ukraine. Not, they've been there, done it, got the T-shirt. And, of course, there are many similarities between the conflict in Ukraine, which is a rather artificial state created by the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991, and what happened in Yugoslavia, where you've got a very varied population, which were all bundled together in one state in 1918. But, of course, what happens with the Western powers is that there is no real matter of principle involved in what they're doing. When it suits their book, they're quite happy to break states up. They're quite happy to break southern Sudan off northern Sudan. They're quite happy to encourage Kurdish separatism in Syria. But the Kosovo Liberation Army was weaponized in order to break up what was rump Serbia. But when the Russians do the same in their, don't forget the Donbass republics voted for independence from Kiev in exactly the same way as the Kosovans. When the Russians intervene to back that up, as they're now doing, what is the difference between that and the NATO intervention in Yugoslavia to force Serbia to accept Kosovan independence? And of course, there isn't really a difference. It's just that it's not do what we say. It's do as we say rather than do as we do. And yeah. Of course, the Russians are very aware of that.
I'm sure they are. Look, Victoria Nuland and her fun and games in 2014 is really at the root of a lot of this. The Maidan coup, a US NATO-backed sponsored coup. And I then spoke to Alex Craner, we're going to hear another clip from him now, about how he thinks some of the people who were behind that 2014 coup are feeling now.
If I were Victoria Nuland, I would regret my project from 2014, because that was a very short-sighted, pyrrhic victory for the neocons in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, some will be saying, well, what's happened today? Why didn't Putin do that back in 2014? I wonder if you think that actually what's happened in Moscow is that they've become actually a lot more confident and more capable since then.
Yeah, that's true. Their alliance with China has become a lot tighter and a lot more solid. They know that they have China behind their back, backing them. I mean, they have solidified their position with Belarus and Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan. I think that they're facing a less volatile situation in Georgia. And so I think that this time around, Russia is feeling a lot more confident. And I mean, to do what they've done today, they must feel extraordinarily confident. This is a very risky operation that they've done, because, you know, with military confrontation, things can go off track. You cannot predict all the outcomes.
Peter, he ends on I think, quite an important point there, is that the Russians have done something quite bold, but they themselves won't necessarily know how this is going to end.
Well, I think they prepared very well. And I think another reason why they act today, but they didn't act in 2014, was the economy wasn't ready. But now they've built up an enormous war chest. They have immense reserves. The world energy situation today is very favorable to Russia, with all its gas and oil. And they've had years of learning how to deal with sanctions. But now all the pieces are in place. I do believe that what we're seeing has been orchestrated very skillfully. but I do believe that the Russians had a plan A and a plan B. They were hoping that the West would take them seriously and realize where the balance of forces really lay. But the West, rather predictably, I would say, missed the opportunity. And so the Russians have implemented plan B.
Peter, what do you think there's any connection with the Russian intervention in the Middle East, in your old neck of the woods in Syria? As I was looking at these airstrikes yesterday by the Russians in Ukraine, seeing them attacking what looked to be things like air bases, military supply bases, military headquarters, the sorts of places, for example, where the British anti-tank missiles would have been coming into the country, where the British always so generous with their handheld anti-tank weapons, and wondering whether there's some sort of comparison with the Israelis over in Syria, who seem to have carte blanche to do a similar sort of thing, attacking various places in Syria where they feel the Iranians or others are aiding the Syrians too much. So this seems to be almost like what Putin's doing in Ukraine is what the Israelis have been up to in Syria for a while now.
Well, thanks to the West's interference in Syria, the Russians have had years of practice and military training in Syria, and they now have the most battle-hardened army in the world. I'm sure this is standing them in good stead for the operations they're carrying out now in Ukraine, and I'm sure they learnt a lot from watching what the Israelis have been doing in Syria. But there's another point here relating to Syria, and that is how America has recognized Israeli sovereignty, or land grab, you might call it, over the Syrian Golan. But when Russia makes a move on Russian-speaking areas of Ukraine, it's all different. The hypocrisy is obscene.
One other factor, of course, which we haven't actually heard much of in the British media is China and hearing Chinese voices. But on Wednesday night, that's just before the invasion, we had a chap called Victor Gao from the Center for China and Globalization popped up on Channel 4 News. And so we'll have a little listen to a short clip with him now as he explains how China views all this. And, of course, the Chinese view on the Russian intervention in the Middle East is also very important. We don't often get to hear. It's almost like China is this gigantic superpower that is so inscrutable. But the fact of the matter is we just very, very rarely get to hear Chinese views and voices in the British media. But we did on Wednesday evening just before the invasion. So let's have a listen to Victor Gao now from the Center for China and Globalization.
Well, first of all, what is happening in Ukraine is of great concern to all countries in the world. And the United Nations has already taken its view. China supports the United Nations Charter. And China emphasizes on respect of national independence, sovereignty, and territorial integrity of any member state of the United Nations. On the other hand, I think for a sovereign country, it does not mean that it can do whatever it wants to do on its soil. NATO should not be allowed to continue to push eastward into countries like Ukraine. And this is, I would say, the core issue of the Ukrainian crisis. For Ukraine to become a NATO member, it will trigger Armageddon.
The international border of Ukraine was infringed by Russian troops, and according to your government, that is unacceptable.
The fact that Ukraine wanted to become a NATO member state, and Ukraine now had US troops and other NATO member troops, weapons stationed on Ukraine soil, does constitute a fundamental threat to Russian interest and security. And Russia has made it very clear they will never tolerate such activities on behalf of Ukraine.
What threatens Armageddon here? Is it the potential membership of an independent sovereign nation state in NATO, which is a defensive alliance, or 190,000 Russian troops encircling Ukraine, an independent country, threatening to invade?
The key issue out of this dilemma is for Ukraine to not to become a NATO member state. I've proposed that the best option now is for Ukraine to become a permanently neutral country. This will solve the problem for everyone involved, and this will create stability for Ukraine, allowing Ukraine to devote itself to peace and stability and development, and become a friend of all countries involved, rather than becoming the tinderbox of war and conflagration, or even triggering an Armageddon.
Well, it's interesting to hear the Chinese there talking twice about Armageddon. Well, of course, they are concerned that Russia has got to have some sort of proper defences from Moscow in order to make sure that we don't get some kind of surprise attack, sneak attack on Moscow itself. So they've got some sort of defence around them. I wonder what you make of the Chinese, Peter. Did you always have good relations with the Chinese when you were chatting with them in the past?
I think the Chinese comments were very pertinent, and I was glad to hear someone else espousing the idea of a neutrality status for Ukraine, like Austria, as I mentioned earlier. This is it's a no-brainer. But the West doesn't want to hear about it because we would lose face and because we would have to give up our ambition to make Ukraine a spearhead for ultimately undermining Moscow. No, the analysis was spot on. I'm amazed that Channel 4 had such a speaker on, although, of course, the interviewer made clear how dreadful he thought those opinions were.
Well, to be fair, the job of the journalist is to put counter points of view. That at least that's what we're supposed to be doing. But what do you make of the Chinese generally? I mean, we get so little real information, I think, Peter, for someone like you that must have dealt with them at some point on an international level. What do you make of them?
Well, there's been a sea change in the last 10, 15 years in Chinese behavior. They were always extremely reticent. They didn't want to get involved. Even when they'd become quite powerful economically, they never wanted to get involved in Syria or anything beyond their backyard. They just wanted to get on with making money, basically, and making a few friends around the world. But because the West has been prodding them and goading them over this, that, and the other, human rights, the Uyghur, Hong Kong, whatever, the South China Sea, they've been forced to become more military-minded, more strategy-minded. Despite their deepest instincts, just to concentrate on internal stability and prosperity, we have more or less forced China to take a position on many issues, and here we have the perfect example with Ukraine, where Russia has gone to get Chinese tacit implied support and received it, and now the Chinese are deeply involved in cooperation with Russia on many levels. I think we're seeing the emergence of a new power bloc, something that the Western powers, if they'd had an ounce of prudence and common sense, would have seen as the thing that really needed to be avoided if the West was ever to keep its position of world eminence. Now you have what will very shortly be, if not already, the world's number one economy, China, in close alliance with one of the top two military powers in the world. And that's our achievement now.
Martin Summers, what do you make of China at the moment, particularly in this case? They're obviously saying they're absolutely backing Russia to the hilt.
Well, obviously, this is tricky for China because obviously one of the things they're concerned about is separatism within China itself, because it's a huge country. And, you know, Tibet was only taken over in the 1950s and so on. So the idea of breaking states up by you know, peeling off little bits of them is something that causes them some considerable concern, and of course during the NATO intervention without UN Security Council backing in Serbia to take Kosovo out of Serbia, you know, which also involved bombing TV stations and stuff. One of the things that happened was the Chinese embassy was bombed. And of course, the Western powers said, "Oh, that was an accident. We didn't really mean to bomb your embassy." But that's not how it was perceived by the Chinese. And I think because their economy is now reaching a point where they need to invest in outside China, they need to take their very successful economic policies out of China and start selling them around the world. And therefore, you know, just through the logic of imperialism, if you like, they've got to take an interest in what goes on in other places. And I think that was obviously, he doesn't speak directly for the Chinese government because he's a think tanker. But you know, that is basically putting their position. And as has been pointed out several times, the obvious solution to this is for Ukraine to be neutral. And I think Zelensky, if he had his own way, would probably have gone down that road. But what's really sad about this is that Zelensky was elected on a peace platform and got Poroshenko out, has been frustrated at every turn by his backers in the West and also by the far right in his own country that have refused that option. And that's what people voted for him for. And you can see two sides to Zelensky. You know, sometimes he talks tough to keep his backers happy. But of course, he's supported by Kolomoisky, who's a major oligarch in Ukraine. And of course, oligarchic politics is normal in Ukraine, far more so than it is in modern Russia. So, I mean, the world system is in a crisis as a result. This is the Ukraine we're talking about at the moment. But of course, the world system is in a crisis. I'd just like to ask Peter a question, really, which is, what your views seem to me to be eminently reasonable. How far does the British Foreign Office still have people like yourself in it? And how far has it been basically taken over by neocon crazies?
thanks for the implied compliment. Very few is the short answer. Very few indeed. They seem to recruit from a different pool than they did all those years ago when I was recruited. The criteria for success now are just being a yes person, and you're more likely, by the way, to be a woman than a man today. That's another big difference. I'm afraid that the caliber has dropped immensely. Though having said that, I'm reminded that my successor in Syria predicted the imminent demise of Assad. Well, we're still waiting for that, more than 10 years on. So even my generation have their faults as well. But you're not encouraged in the Foreign Office to have an independent mind. You don't get very far. You never have done, and never will.
Can I just add a supplementary to that? Lavrov is a civil servant. He's the Russian foreign minister, but he's a civil servant, and he's been in place for many years now. Very experienced, as you said earlier. And of course, in the US system, the top people are appointed by the president. But we've got Liz Truss, who's a minor MP, who's suddenly been given all of this enormous power. Isn't there a bit of an asymmetry there?
Exactly, and that's why I say that Russia has been exercising some adult supervision in China, in Syria, for example. If the West had had its way, Assad would have been removed and ISIS would have been in Damascus. But Russia, fortunately, stepped in, exercised some adult supervision and saved us from that. I suppose it's partly down to the fact that our politicians come and go. They're never in a job for very long, whereas Lavrov, has, as you pointed out, has had many years of experience. But it's also a question of national mentality. I'm afraid we British are very complacent, self-satisfied, smug. You can tune into any mainstream media broadcast, especially the BBC, and you can pick up the tones of smugness. We pride ourselves on staying calm in a crisis. How stupid is that? Our go-to response to any crisis now is panic stations.
Yes, it's the latest crisis, isn't it? There's always another one just around the corner. The Munich Security Conference, a lot of the action around Ukraine seems to have almost revolved around this, which happened last weekend. And this is where every year all of the Western powers come together to discuss these things. We're going to move away from Ukraine now and just look at that Munich Security Conference just as we wind up, Peter, by having a listen to somebody who popped up there I certainly wasn't expecting to see, whose name is William Gates. You know, this is the guy behind Gavi, which is the big international vaccination lobby. And so I was amazed to see Bill Gates there doing a speech. But I suppose security now is also very much about looking out for the next pandemic. So let's have a listen to hear what Bill Gates had to say about that last weekend.
There were a lot of people in 2015 after the Ebola epidemic who were talking about what needed to be done. And in this pandemic, the countries that had some exposure to SARS-CoV-1 were amongst the outliers. You know, so Australia is a true outlier. They orchestrated diagnostics, they executed quarantine policies, and they have a death rate in a different league than the other rich countries. I mean, just utterly different. And everybody had the capability to do that. They, you know, have less PCR machines than other rich countries. It wasn't some thing. They had more travelers coming in from China than other countries. So hopefully, you know, given the so many negative things, not just the millions of deaths and the economic toll, but the lack of schooling, depression, overdose deaths. I mean, it's, you know, hard to make the entire list. As you say, you know, for men, more men died. For women, more women had, you know, unacceptable burdens thrust onto them. So the cost of being ready for the next pandemic is not super large. It's not like climate change where, you know, 10 trillion, 20 trillion, these are big numbers. You know, global surveillance capability would cost like $1 billion a year. The R&D that we need to do to get magic vaccines and diagnostics and therapeutics, you know, that's less than $100 billion over the next decade. So, you know, if we're rational, yes, the next time we'll catch it early. And it won't go global like it did this time.
Well, that's Bill Gates speaking last weekend at the Munich Security Conference, saying, well, you know, a cool $10 billion on the development of these magic vaccines, and we'll be ready for the next pandemic. This is the week, Peter, where we in Britain have just been let off the leash with no more COVID restrictions anymore. I wonder what you make of the restrictions that there have been and the illness over the last couple of years, and also whether we should be making sure we spend this $10 billion on the preparing for the next one.
Well, it's so interesting to hear one of our oligarchs, Bill Gates, holding forth, because it reminds us that we're now in a world no longer of healthcare, but biosecurity. Biosecurity. Healthcare is just one aspect of national security. And it's been used as a weapon against our people for the last two years to keep us under control and surveillance. Another buzz word, obviously, one that Bill Gates likes. But I'm struck actually by the parallels between the Ukraine situation and the COVID situation. Because the germophobes are basically the same as the Russophobes. Have you noticed that? It's the same cast of characters. The Russophobes, the most strident, hysterical critics of Russia, people like the BBC, the Labour Party, progressive liberals, that includes much of the Tory party as well, are all fiendishly, hysterically Russophobic, while on the other side, there are just one or two lonely figures of the right, Nigel Farage a little bit, Trump ambiguously praising Putin, and one or two lonely voices of the what I call the left behind, Piers Corbyn. Piers, not his brother Jeremy, the left behind, people like Piers Corbyn, the true left, abandoned by the official Labour Party. So this is the cast of characters on both subjects. So the parallels are very interesting. And the techniques of propaganda are so similar, aren't they? Build up the hysteria, make sure that any dissenting voices are suppressed, like the attempt to silence RT, the impossibility of hearing any alternative COVID narrative on the mainstream media, the use of hospital pictures. The parallels are so close, whether it's Ukraine, COVID, or Syria, they reach for the same propaganda tools. This is a battle for freedom being fought on more than one front.
I must give Martin Summers, a Labour Party member, a chance to respond to that, Martin, particularly about the Labour Party's failures with regard to Ukraine and also countering the Tories when it comes to, and Boris, particularly when it comes to COVID.
This is probably where I'm probably going to disagree, but then that's the inevitable. Everybody can't agree about everything. If you look at China, for example, they have pursued a fairly robust lockdown and test and trace policy. They certainly haven't. They've also got their own vaccines, as we know.
Yeah, Martin, rather than talking about China, can you just address Peter's points about the lobby here in the UK, the Labour Party?
OK, well, the Labour Party is now, Starmer is picking up on the Ukraine stuff as a stick to beat the left with. There's no doubt about it. I mean, the people who signed the Stop the War statement about it, about Ukraine, were all forced to retract, even though the Stop the War has called for Russia to withdraw from Ukraine and therefore and stop trying to get into NATO. There's a whole topic around what happened with COVID. You and I, Tony, we have these chats every week about what COVID actually is. I think it is a bioweapon. We know that the Pentagon were, in fact, funding the gain-of-function research in the Wuhan laboratory, and the timing of when it broke out is very significant, just after the Chinese New Year, after attacks, after their pig herd had died off, after their chicken flock had died off as a result of infections. And, of course, we know from the Times of Israel that the Israeli Defense Forces were told in November 2019 that a pandemic was coming out of China.
Yeah, well, that may well have been going around the intelligence services, but I just want...
Well, I'm just saying that implies they had foreknowledge of what was going to happen.
I just don't think you've really addressed Peter's question that he's making there about the voices in the Labour Party who, you know, you would have expected an opposition to oppose on both of these issues. They've done so on neither.
No, well, what you've found is politically... The right of the Tory party have been the ones who've been most against lockdowns. Lockdown, in fact, fits in with quite a lot of mainstream Labour ideology. We're all in it together, Captain Tom and all the rest of it. So it's quite straightforward why they've gone down that road. And the splits actually developing are very interesting, all of this. People, you know, it's like a Venn diagram. I agree that there's what you might call a progressive consensus, totalitarian, soft left mind control thing, but it's more, you know, once you get down to nitty gritty details and individuals, it doesn't actually plan out exactly the same way. Okay. What I find extraordinary is that somebody like Gates, who is basically a computer person who made his money by being very wealthy and in the right place at the right time. He had loads of money before he even set up Microsoft. Why is he at a security conference? I mean, the Bretton Woods discussions in 1947, that Wall Street and the financiers weren't even represented. Everybody came together. It was governments that decided things.
Well, the reason
I mean, we're corporatizing everything.
The reason he's there is because he's looking at biosecurity, and also he's a very wealthy man. Anyway, well,
indeed,
look,
but I mean, that is as Peter pointed out. This is a healthcare issue, not a biosecurity issue, unless, of course, it is a biological warfare agent, which then makes a lot of things explicable.
Anyway, before you say goodbye, Peter, I wonder if you just like have any closing comments, and you can we'll let you leave.
I'm struck by another parallel between COVID and Ukraine, and it's how lockdown is equivalent to sanctions. It's a panicky response on the part of governments who haven't a clue and who end up shooting themselves in the foot. But they use drastic means to do so. And the second point is that I've been very impressed by what Martin has been saying. And I was thinking all the time, especially in the discussion of sanctions and economies, how this is missing from the mainstream media. I haven't heard anything even close to what Martin was explaining. I found that very interesting.
Okay, Peter, we'll let you go. I don't know if you're on Twitter or things like that, your socials. Would you like to share those with listeners?
Very happy. I don't tweet myself. I'm a passive consumer. but I'm very happy to pass on anything that I may have said.
Okay, former ambassador to Syria, British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
And Martin, we've got one final item. Going to be finishing a little bit early, I hope, this week, which is looking at New Zealand, one of your favourite countries, which is, I found fascinating because there's the last few weeks there's been a protest going on in Wellington where we've had hundreds of people, some say thousands. There's probably about 2,000-3,000 people outside the Parliament, the New Zealand Parliament in Wellington. All sorts of attempts being made to now break that up and get them to go home, a bit like what was happening in Canada, and in fact the whole thing started roughly around about the same time. This is all again, of course, over just before you ask questions about what it might be about. It's about vaccine mandates and actually making sure that people are not losing their jobs in New Zealand because of the imposition of draconian vaccine mandates. And the recording we're going to hear now is from there just a couple of days ago. A guy called 5-1 Phil. Now, what his real name is, I'm not sure. But anyway, he did an interview or several interviews, very much looking as if he'd been beaten up. And he's sort of bruised and blackened faces after having been released from police custody in Wellington. And he had this to say about the way that the police had been treating people. Particularly interesting, though, is first of all, this car which drives into the police, but the police are ready for it. And so they part, but they do a little stage act, pretend act, he says, where they pretend that they have just been driven into by the car. He also said that he spotted, although not on this clip, on a different clip, he said he spotted a little earpiece in the ear of the driver of the car, as if the whole thing was staged in order to make it look as if the police were attacked by this car driver who was actually quite friendly with the police in reality. And then he talks about one of the protesters supposedly trying to throw things at police, where he was out there kind of leading this part of the protest. He gets hit on the back of the head by one of the so-called protesters. So sounds to me like we've got quite a few agent provocateurs down there in Wellington at the moment. But anyway, let's have a listen now to 5-1 Phil down at the Wellington protest a couple of days ago. And then Martin will hear what you make of this.
There were only about 20 protesters and about 30 police, and they were lined up and they had already moved the bollards a good 30 metres down the street. And I said, form up here, we need to hold the line and brace. And there was arguments amongst the protesters. Nobody seemed to be listening. They were arguing amongst each other. So while those arguments were occurring, I saw this car coming. And I pulled back a little. It was a white car. It came in real fast, then slowed right down. And they hit their brakes, and the police all moved apart before they even got to slow down and hit their brakes, like they expected it coming. And they parted, and it stopped right there. And they went, oh, like they'd been hit, but none of them had been. And then they surrounded the car and started hitting it with torches on the windows. There was only one occupant in the car, and the 20 or so protesters were all focused at that. I had fallen back, and I looked over, and I could see about 40 forming up on the quad on the right. If you go up to where the bollards are, you'll see exactly what I mean. And at that point, I yelled, we need to fall back and we need to form up. And about six people came with me. And just at that point, the guys with the riot shields ran past our front line and ran down the side of the footpath. So I booted it down. As you can see, I'm not overly fit. So I was a bit slower than some. When I got down to just before the toilets, I turned around and one of the cops had engaged a rather large guy named Dylan. Dylan grabbed the shield and just tossed him aside like a child. Just and he fell on the ground and I stopped right there and I put out my arms and said, nobody passes quick because we're not here to injure people. We're about love and peace, but they come with force, with their riot shields. You know, we have to defend the people, we have to defend the toilets, because they'll take our toilets and that's just one step to get rid of us. After that, it seemed like about 5 or 10 seconds, but it was probably 2 or 3 seconds later, the shield wall hit me. I got knocked back a little bit, and then some idiot from amongst the protesters threw something at the police and hit me in the back of the head. That was from the protesters. I hate to see that. And I just want to say to all the protesters out here, that's bullshit. Don't ever do that. You hit me by accident, but if you had hit a police officer, they might have charged our line. They might have hurt women and children. That's just stupid. Don't do it. The cops are not our enemies. There's one or two that are bad eggs. The rest of the cops are great. Anyway, by hit me again and then gouged my eyes. There's footage of this. What I'm saying is not just me making a story. There's footage of this everywhere, people. It's on Facebook, it's on Twitter. Look me up on Portaloo Phil or 5to1 Phil. It's out there. Portaloo Phil or 5to1 Phil. Yeah. My Twitter handle, 5to1 Phil, or us. PHIL or NZ Fubar, you'll see it on his feed. And that's what happened. And by the time he gouged my eyes, I had had enough. And I'm not a violent person. I preach, you know, to be peaceful, and we're here for freedom. But the eye gouge got me. I charged the line. I broke through their line, and of course that isolated me, and they just jumped on me and threw me to the ground, stole my phone, and took me, carted me off to Central, and they've charged me with obstructing the police.
So that is his name is 5to1 Phil or Portaloo Phil. It seems like quite a lot of struggles down at this protest, Martin, are to do with the control of the toilets.
Well, obviously, I wasn't there and I can't really comment on the actual incident that he's referring to. But it wouldn't be surprising if there were agents provocateurs in a protest like that. I'll just tell a short story about as a Stop the War activist. When Bush came to London to meet Blair, some years ago now, we all went down to London to protest about it. And we were outside Downing Street protesting. And one of the protesters grabbed, there was a sort of, you know, barrier in front of us and the police were behind the barrier. And he started grabbing the barrier and trying to pull it down and screaming and shouting that we needed to get in and get at Bush. Anyway, most people were ignoring him, but it was, you know, it was turning into a bit of a confrontational atmosphere. And then the guy standing next to me said, hang on a minute, I know that guy. I met him at a gay party on Saturday night. He's a police inspector. And George Galloway was standing nearby. He said, he's a police inspector. He's a police inspector. He then ran off and in actual fact stopped the war. We photographed him. We made a formal complaint about that guy. And he was indeed a police inspector who was trying to foment a riot outside Downing Street. And if people think that stuff doesn't go on, I've got a suspension bridge to sell you. It goes on all the time. There's a book called What Everyone Should Know About State Repression, which came out in the 1900s. I can't remember who wrote it, written by a Russian guy. This is standard practice by police forces all over the world. And it's the way things are done.
Well, that's it for tonight. We're finishing a little bit early. A special programme all about Ukraine and the invasion yesterday by the Russians. And I'd just like really to repeat what I think is a very important statement, which I haven't seen anywhere used on any of the Western press, made by the Russian President Putin yesterday morning at the time of the invasions. He announced it to his nation, which was the following quote. He says, if we look at the sequence of events and the incoming reports, the showdown between Russia and these NATO forces cannot be avoided. It's only a matter of time. They're getting ready and waiting for the right moment. We cannot stay idle and passively observe these developments. This would be an absolutely irresponsible thing for us to do. For our country, it's a matter of life and death, a matter of our historical future as a nation. It is not an exaggeration, it is a fact, says Putin, which is a pretty strong case, which you won't hear on the Western media, for them actually having to go and secure Ukraine, knowing that the Western arms, instead of dealing with the Russians over Christmas and the New Year and into 2022 to build a new peace security treaty for Eastern Europe, and specifically around Ukraine, guaranteeing that NATO wasn't going to become a NATO member. Instead of that, the West just simply turned its back on this opportunity. And so they've now got what's happened this week, which is the invasion by Russia and the overturning. Martin, final comment from you. The overturning, isn't it, really, of the events of 2014?
Well, the events of 2014 were orchestrated by the Western intelligence services, including the sniper attack in the Maidan Square. There have been court cases in Kiev, independent court cases, where the Berkut riot police were exonerated. They didn't carry out the attack. It was carried out by mercenaries from Georgia and Lithuania, orchestrated by NATO intelligence services. And that was the crime. And those people should be on trial.
Possibly British guns and British bullets.
But, oh, yes, British Special Forces undoubtedly involved, I'd say.
Nobody
in Ireland's going to be surprised by that.
My take on it, though, is that what happened in 2014 was a sort of sneaky thing to do. It was all done covertly. The idea was to try and blame somebody else for the deaths of loads of innocent people, whereas actually what Putin has been doing this week is very much he's wearing his heart on his sleeve, isn't he?
He is. And I think, as Peter Ford suggested earlier, I think the Russians are going to look for a quick victory here. They want to do what they need to do and get out and then leave the Ukrainians to sort out their own business.
And I know
I don't
you're
think
going
they
to
intend to occupy the country at all.
I know you're going to tell me
that would be a disaster from their point of view.
I know you're going to tell me that Putin's got no intentions to go into Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, these other NATO countries. But then this time last week, you were telling us all that Putin wasn't going to go into Ukraine either.
No, what I said on RT the last time I was on last week is that the Russian army could have invaded any of these countries at any time. NATO is only a fiction, really. Short of nuclear war, if the Russians wanted to reconquer all of what they used to have control of right up to the German border, They could, and nobody could stop them without nuking them. But they don't want to do that. They want to actually have a modernized society with social welfare built into it. That's one of the things that's caused Putin problems is the pension reform, which is desperately unpopular and led to United Russia losing many votes to the Communist Party. If people followed Russian politics, they'd know all of this. And of course, the Communist Party take a tougher line than Putin. Putin's actually a moderate. And if they got rid of Putin, they'd have to deal with Zyuganov, who was the guy that was going to take power in 1998, which led to the bombings and all the rest of it. The Western intelligence services have been terroristic for decades. And the same, and what you've got is these useless sock puppet politicians in the House of Commons, none of whom have a clue about what NATO intelligence services really are. They are just front people.
But I noticed Andrew Kripko in an article was saying a much larger war that could dangerously escalate into World War III was averted by Russia's preemptive special operation in Ukraine this week, aimed at neutralising the US and NATO's latent, imminent and hot threats emanating from that country. This makes Moscow's military mission truly a peacemaking one, since the Eurasian great power responsibly sought to prevent World War III, not spark it. Russia truly had no choice but to act now. Would you agree with that?
I broadly would agree with that. I think there were other ways they might have chosen to play it, but I'm not running Russia. And if, you know, talking about the Churchill, Johnson thinking himself as Churchill, Putin sees himself as Marshal Zhukov. And of course, does Kerry McCarthy know who Marshal Zhukov was? The guy who won the war for Russia and the Soviet Union and won the war for everybody. This is what the Russians get very fed up about. They have basically suffered enormously through war. And in the 1990s, when Western puppets were in charge, their society was wrecked. It was horrific. And it was like Thatcherism in this country, but on steroids. They ain't going back there again. And they're going to, the West is basically, the West... some forces in the West are quite happy for an Iron Curtain to go down. They're over there, we're over here. But of course, over there is now the rest of humanity. Russia, China, the developing world, and the Western world is getting smaller and smaller, and its banking system is on the verge of collapse. And one big kick and it'll go down, and there'll be revolutions everywhere. That's what's going to happen.
Well, we shall see. So it's time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko and our live guest, former British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, the full-length interviews, story link, the comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate, amazingly, at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Those full-length interviews this week with Alex Craner, with Chris Hewitt, and... with Matthew Williams. They will be up there later tonight. My two books, I've got one on the 30 years of research into the dodgiest ever deals done between the Allies and the Nazis at the end of the Second World War. That's called The Traitors of Arnhem. The other one is The Siege of Heaven Reader, and that is basically to do with secret government from Cromwell to the assassination of Princess Diana. That's an anthology, all of them available via www.bilderberg.org. But you can't share them on Facebook because Bilderberg.org, of course, is some sort of dangerous site that Facebook will not allow you to use. Of course, many people are now going over to VK.com, which is a Russian equivalent of Facebook, as things like this start to get banned. So this show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, except when we're restreaming the Richie Allen show. And... over Sunday lunch also at radio at Camberley's radioqeuk.com. So please do make live recordings. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft. Well, that is actually not true. We normally have been streaming live from there, but not this week. We're streaming from homes and also from RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and self-censorship of life-saving information is sadly the norm in Britain today, thanks to the Nazi collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses, the glorious Fourth Reich. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Here's wishing you a relaxing an enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.